It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech. Greg Farrow from the Packet Pushers Network is here, along with Georgia Dow, Jason Heiner. We'll talk about those AMD security flaws. Are they genuine or just a stock manipulation attempt? We'll also talk about Qualcomm and Broadcom and why the U.S. government killed the deal and whether it was a good idea, and why I'm quitting Facebook, this time for the last time. It's all coming up next on TWiT.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 658, recorded Sunday, March 18th, 2018. The Matador Defense. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Eero. Never think about Wi-Fi again with Eero's hyper-fast, super-simple Wi-Fi system. And now the second generation Eero is tri-band and twice as fast. For free overnight shipping to the U.S. or Canada, visit Eero.com, select overnight shipping at checkout, and enter the code TWIT. And by Roman, a men's health company that offers remote online diagnosis for ED and convenient monthly delivery of medication. For $50 off your first month, visit GetRoman.com/TWIT. And by Quip. Make a fresh start this year with a Quip electric toothbrush. It cleans like a premium electric brush at a fraction of the cost. Visit GetQuip.com/TWIT to get your first refill pack free when you purchase any Quip electric toothbrush. And by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/TWIT2. It's time for TWIT This Week in Tech, the show where we talk about the latest tech news. And each week we assemble a new panel hoping to find the perfect combination of wit, wisdom, and savoir-faire. And I think we've done it. Let's start with Jason Heiner from Tech Republic. What is that under your lip?
Lip gloss.
Yeah. You have grown since I saw you last. You've grown what do they call that? A hip
soul patch.
Soul patch. Yeah. You look good. I like it.
Yeah.
Are you taking up the clarinet?
No saxophone.
It's good. I like it.
Just kidding. I can't play. I did play the clarinet actually, in high school, mostly cause I wanted to play the saxophone, but my family owned a clarinet. And so exactly they said, you get to play the clarinet.
One reads much like the other.
Indeed.
Nice to see you, Jason. To Jason's right, we have the fabulous Georgia Dow from iMore.com. Hello, Georgia.
Hello. I wanted to learn the drums, so my parents got me an accordion.
What is wrong with parents?
They didn't love me enough.
Get the instrument kid wants.
It was also a family member had it. They could get it for $50. So I, I was the hip accordion player.
And I did, in fact, buy my child a drum kit when he was about 8. And that was the biggest mistake I ever made. do not get drum kits for your children. I understand what your parents are up to. They did not want to hear you banging the skins at 4 a.m. No. Greg Farrow, he's the Packet Pusher from Packet Pushers Network and Ethereal Mind on the Twitter. Great to see you again, Greg.
Thank you so much, Leo. It's good to be back. Sorry, I haven't been able to get up there physically in person, but I'm curtailing my travel plans for the year ahead to try and focus on generating content.
Ah, nice. On the Packet Pushers Network?
Yeah, we're upping our writing and video work, so we're increasing our YouTube. Fantastic. Commentary, and we're also building, overhauling the website and doing static content. So we're looking forward to getting that.
Right. So I understand you got in a lot of trouble with your audience for making a change in your recommendations recently.
Yeah, well, part of being an IT expert, you know, when you're an IT professional, you get a lot of certifications. We all go out and study and learn stuff, and then some people go on to pass exams to qualify them, and it's time for me to move on and to walk away. So I just published a little post saying, you know, letting my certification status go in this area.
You don't need it. You're certified. Certifications are people who don't have experience.
Yep. Yeah. Well, it's like, you know, the people who go to the insane asylum and you get a certificate when you come out to say that you're sane. But does anybody who's never been to the insane asylum actually have a certificate?
So which cert is it that you're letting go by the wayside?
It's associated with the Cisco CCIE program. It's their elite.
You don't need that anymore. Do you pay? Have to pay every year to be a CCIE?
It's complicated. Something like that. Yeah, you have to maintain touch and status and lodge some stuff to say that you're still working in the industry and you're in touch. You haven't just walked away and done nothing for the last 5 years and losing your company.
I believe that you are a certified internetwork expert.
I was.
That's no joke, though. It's like the PhD of certifications. So I see why people were probably like, "Oh my gosh, why would you do that?" You know, I did way back in the day. This is like 20 years ago. I did a CCNA, which is sort of the entry level.
I remember that, yeah.
Cisco, you know, certification. So CCIE.
Did you look up at CCIEs like they were the gods?
Of course, absolutely.
Yeah. Yes,
I mean, I think when I entered the room and everything, you know.
I think that there's a substantial change going on in technology. So for people who are IT professionals, we're seeing a change away from, you know, certifications and basic knowledge as a career path to people building portfolios, career portfolios, right. In the same way that artists have a portfolio. I think that IT professionals must have a GitHub site with code and a blog showing that they know about these things and writing stories. And that shows you can communicate. It shows what you know. It demonstrates your capabilities rather than, you know, I passed this exam, therefore I must know what I'm doing. I think employers are looking for much more interesting capabilities, and the old days of certificates as being the be-all and end-all has passed. That's my logic. No doubt.
Since you guys are both here, and you too, George, although I think you and I will have less to say about this, let's talk about Risenfall, which is a wonderful name for an exploit. Actually, there are thirteen critical flaws, four basic ideas that are affecting AMD processors. We learned about it on Tuesday. In fact, Steve Gibson took this so seriously, he kind of rebuilt Security Now to talk about this, but I haven't heard a word since. And there was some concern because the group that found this wasn't super well known, CTS Labs, and they did something that is considered anathema to the security industry. They discovered it and revealed it pretty much at the same time without giving AMD the requisite 90 days to patch. Have you heard anything about Rise and Fall since then as AMD stepped forward? What do we know?
My favorite part about this story is that apparently they're monetizing the bug by short selling AMD stock.
That's so, what worried me. And that was kind of there was this undercurrent of concern that maybe this company really, first of all, they didn't put out proof of concept code, although some say they've seen it. So it's hard to demonstrate that this is an actual flaw. And yeah, that was some concern there. Maybe they're short sellers just trying to get AMD stock to dump and they can make some money on that.
Yeah, the story that I've heard about the Ryzen vulnerabilities, it's pretty hard to understand how the scale of this without the code showing the vulnerabilities and without AMD admitting to what's happening. And they haven't had enough time to examine this and to see and to make a public, you know, literally they announced it on gave them 24 hours notice, which isn't enough time with CPUs. No. So it's hard to criticize AMD for not reacting already. The theory is that increasingly these security researchers aren't releasing bugs without making money out of them. So the downside of the bug bounty programs that we've seen start, all of the bug bounty programs that are going on, is that security researchers reasonably, in my opinion, expect to get paid for finding these vulnerabilities because the companies who get the benefit of these bugs are for profit, like sometimes billions of dollars worth of profit. Why shouldn't they?
Here's the argument against that. It then becomes, and Apple refused to do this for the longest time. They've only recently started paying bug bounties. Their concern was, and I think it's legitimate, that then you create a market for bugs, and it's hard to outbid governments that will pay millions of dollars for these bugs if they're usable for exploits. And so suddenly you have this auction that goes through the roof. And really, I think it's not unreasonable to expect security firms to notify the company that created the software or hardware and give them a fair amount of time to fix it. And I don't think necessarily saying, but you have to give us $100,000 first. It makes me feel a little queasy.
I don't think AMD even has a bug bounty program. So how else were they going to monetize it?
By short selling the stock?
Why not? It's as good a way as any, and it's virtually untraceable.
Good Lord.
And, you know, if AMD is not going to play ball, is not going to own up to its responsibilities and offer a bug bounty for people who report them, then this is the sort of thing that you're going to get. And these researchers are doing it for money. And the bug bounty programs, love them or hate them. Yes, you're right. Some security researchers will only work white hat. And increasingly, they'll only work inside of the bug bounty programs because they get legal protection and corporate protection when they're inside the bug bounty companies.
Linus Torvalds, the creator of Linux, did raise this specter that maybe these are short sellers. CTS Labs, which isn't well known, he said, when was the last time you saw a security advisory that was basically, quote, if you replace the BIOS of the CPU microcode with an evil version, you might have a security problem. Yeah. He says, yeah. You know, it isn't really a flaw. And the idea of publicizing this so quickly was really to make money off a short sell. Dan yep. Guido, who has a great name, he is the CEO of Trail of Bits, which is a security company that at least is somewhat known, tweeted, and I'll show you Guido's tweet. He said, yeah, no, I've seen the proof of code. By the way, here's proof of Chrome being sucky on Windows 10. Come on, Chrome. Come on, you can do it. Show that tweet. I don't know why it has so much trouble rendering Twitter. You see what it's doing here? It's just going crazy. Anyway, Dan Guido's response on Twitter. Oh, it came up briefly. on Twitter was, regardless of the hype around the release, the bugs are real, accurately described in the technical report, which is not available to public, and their exploit code works. Now, the flaws do require admin privileges, but they are all flaws, not expected functionality. So the fact that, and you can read more about it at the CTS custom crafted website, amdflaws.com. Which, by the way,
good vulnerabilities. Yeah, they clearly you've got to have a brand for your brand.
They clearly spent some time. They've got a clever name: Rise and Fall, Master Key, Fallout, and Chimera. They've got logos. They've got a YouTube video. I mean, they've been working on this a lot harder for the last, I would say, month.
See what I mean about a portfolio? Now you've got a portfolio, you've built your brand, you've got your bug out there. So next time you go for a job, you can say, I was, rise and fall, that was me, should demonstrate proof of work. I think it's right for these researchers to expect to get paid for the work. They're fundamentally doing work that these companies have failed to do themselves,
that's
in
a
my
good
view.
Point. Yep. Right? That's a good point.
Right? AMD is Intel knew about the vulnerability in their CPUs and actively ignored it. Is the message that I've been seeing?
For 20 some years, they ignored speculation,
and it's been found several times, I believe.
Yeah, speculative execution. We saw a white paper written in 1995 that said, this is going to leak information, and everybody just blithely ignored it. So, Jason, what do you tell your enterprise readers that they should do about this? Is this something they should worry about?
I mean, this was a tough one, right? Because you don't really know yet what the, potential damage. Now, a lot of companies aren't using servers running AMD processors, right? That's the things that they care a lot about is the data that's on servers. AMD's not in a whole lot of servers. Intel has an even bigger share of that market. Obviously you have devices out there that have this, that it's going to put some of your most important data at risk potentially. And so, until we know have a better idea what some of the risks are, what you have to do is just sort of be on, is have your radar up, which they always do anyway, of course. But, when you're looking at which devices to put out there, and which devices, are most vulnerable, which devices might have some of your most valuable data, most sensitive stuff on it, you may want to be careful if you've got devices that have AMD CPUs that might have some super, super sensitive, IP or other kinds of data, and you may want to move it away from, some of those devices. Those are the kinds of things that you know, the enterprises and think about from a risk management standpoint.
CTS Labs, when asked by Tom's Hardware, well, why didn't you give AMD the normal 90-day courtesy? They said, well, we consider these so severe, we didn't think AMD would be able to fix this for many, many months or even a year. So we decided to give them 24 hours.
Interesting.
It doesn't fly. I mean, just to go back to what Jason was saying, I just to draw some specifics out of that, a lot of firewalls, routers, storage arrays, a lot of custom appliances run AMD CPUs. Most people who buy servers from the traditional vendors, they're not AMDs. But the vendors who make hard appliances are often running AMD. Now, they're not often running...
Yeah, that's a good point.
...accessible code. So if you're looking at your firewalls, it's hard to get an injection point or to get through the attack surface. But they're the devices that rise and fall is much more likely to affect because AMD is much stronger in the appliance market.
And by the way, other people like Alex Ionescu, who's well-known in the security community, have said, I've seen the technical details. There are legit design and implementation issues worth discussing as part of a coordinated disclosure effort. The media storm and handling around that is sadly distracting from a real conversation around security boundaries. And so his takeaway from this is really the issue is people shouldn't have admin-level access to this hardware. There's another issue, though, that's interesting. One of the reasons AMD was bit by some of these flaws is that they, in their system on a chip, they used chips created by a third company that apparently left a back door in the hardware. And whether intentionally or by accident, that's a big issue as well, right?
Yeah, and like obviously this is something they're all doing because Intel had that problem a while back as well,
right,
with their onboard management chip running Minix,
right,
which has got so many vulnerabilities, it's basically, you know, unsafe for anybody to use, much less to put it inside a world-class CPU. So I think what we're seeing here is all of the silicon makers have sort of been caught out here, but with the increasing focus on security. You're going to see more of this. I think we're going to see more in baseband modems. There's the iPhone vulnerability, which is on the list to talk about tonight. Same sort of thing. There's a lot more money on the table. These bug bounty programs, places to sell these compromises means there's more work being done on security. You're going to see much more of this type of stuff come out in the short term because it's worthwhile doing. It's now actually a financial basis. People can spend their lives making a living out of just finding these vulnerabilities.
Yeah, and again, that's both good and bad. That's one of the reasons bug bounties are both good because they encourage people to find them, but bad because they encourage people to find them. So, you know, I have mixed feelings. Obviously, security by obscurity is not a good kind of security. So it is better to get these out. By the way,
in sports, they call this matador defense. You know, you just lift the cape and let them right on through, you know. So unfortunately, it's showing up. We're finding so much more than we have before, which is a good thing, right? That's the one counter argument to this is by them making it public, people that, to Greg's point, that might have a storage array with some of their most sensitive data that has AMD chip in it, you know, that they're going to likely move that data off of there because they don't know because of the unknown. And right. So it's better to know than to have nation states or other bad guys, you know, on the black market that do know and are going to compromise potentially.
Bottom line from Motherboard, some of these new AMD flaws will be hard to patch and malicious hackers with a certain level of skill might be able to find ways to exploit them before they're patched, according to Guido. But, and this is, I guess, the message for our audience, regular consumers shouldn't worry about them probably. The real problems are more for cloud providers and big enterprises. And now that they know about them, they can do the matador defense. Does that involve a bull and a red cape? I'm not sure.
You know, the matador defense, you hold the cape up and then you just let them right
over. Yeah,
there you go.
Over here.
Right on
Look
through.
Over here.
Right on through.
Well, and making sure people don't get admin access, things like that. You know, if you have to have admin access to take advantage of these, well, that's something that enterprises can address and servers can address. And they shouldn't be allowing admin access anyway. I guess you maybe have this would be a cascade attack where you have a malware that gets you escalated access and then you can apply these.
This is where, you know, the impact of this is fairly unknown at this point in time. The exploit code's not published. That doesn't mean that people aren't out there actively trying to write code as we speak.
Right.
But at this point in time, there doesn't seem to be anything in the wild. Whereas with Spectre and Meltdown, people were publishing exploit code within a few hours. of that coming live, you know, or proof of concept exploit code, not a working exploit.
So, and by the way, there's a little bit of karma in this, because remember when Spectre and Meltdown were revealed, AMD immediately put out a press release saying, not us! And then we found out, well, as a matter of fact, you.
Yeah, so. that karma is hitting pretty hard right now.
Instant karma gonna get you. Right. Georgia, we'll have something for you to talk about in a sec.
Don't worry.
Poor Georgia. We're sitting here going, rah, rah, rah. But I want to take a break. When we come back, I'll talk to you about why I deleted my Facebook account last night. And I'm pretty head up. I'm pretty mad about what Facebook's been up to. So maybe we can get into that in a second. First, let's talk about making your Wi-Fi work. The worst thing in the world is the shout. And I hear it from time to time. I did anyway, from your spouse saying, honey, the Wi-Fi's down. Or worse, you're watching, you know, the last season of the last episode of the last season of Game of Thrones. And all of a sudden, the buffering. And you go, what? She walked in the fire. That's why we got an Eero. And I haven't had the problem since. I'm happy to say Eero is enterprise-grade Wi-Fi in your home that's easy to set up, easy to use, and solves those problems. It's designed to solve the problems. Modern Wi-Fi, unfortunately, you know, we live in an environment where everything we went from one or two or three devices on your Wi-Fi network. I have 45 on my Wi-Fi network, and that's pretty common between your lights and your Echoes, your TVs, your laptops, your phones. Wi-Fi is doing a lot of work. Plus, your neighbor's got Wi-Fi. And sometimes your neighbor has one of those Wi-Fi routers with 18 antennas that's designed to knock you off. Eero solves this problem. We started played with Eero when it first came out 2 years ago, early 2016. And here's one of the things that's great about Eero. They've learned over the last 2 years from hundreds of thousands of systems, and they've been making them smarter, faster, and more reliable. A couple of things you want in a router. In any IoT device, number one, you want it to be over-the-air firmware upgradable. And Eero does exactly that. Upgrades come automatically. They're automatically applied. Not just security, but they're improving the system all the time. In fact, the new second-generation Eero and the Eero Beacon, those are great. The Eero Beacon, you just plug into the wall, are more perfectly tailored to fit your needs in your home than ever before. More speed and range. They're tri-band now. Same beautiful design people love. I don't mind people seeing the router in the hall or in the living room because it's unobtrusive. It's gorgeous. And because they're now tri-band, they have that third 5 gigahertz radio. The second generation Eero is twice as fast as its predecessor. And that means you can do more in every room of your home. They have a Thread radio now, which means you can connect to low power devices like locks and doorbells and other sensors. It's easy to expand your coverage. We started with the basic kit, which was a base unit and two beacons. I've added a couple of beacons because then I put a camera outside and I wanted to make sure it could get to the Wi-Fi from the garage. So I put an Eero in the garage. It's easy to do. If there's an outlet, there's Wi-Fi. Free overnight shipping to the U.S. or Canada. Visit Eero.com and at checkout select overnight shipping. Then enter the offer code TWIT to make it free. I love also Eero has the new Eero Plus, which gives me much more control. I can do things like with my Amazon Echo, I can say, what you do is I've assigned all the devices in the house to different users. And our 15-year-old, I assigned his computer, his phone, his tablet to Michael. And now I can tell Amazon Echo, pause Michael's internet. And it's so much fun. You wait for the scream. And one, two, three. Hey! he can't unpause it, by the way. With the Echo, he has to use the app, and he doesn't have access to the app. We also are able to filter for safe sites, for violence, for sex, all sorts of things. And malware, too. In fact, I have the whole house filtered through Eero Plus for malware. It's just a great system. Try it at Eero, Eero.com. And again, the offer code TWIT gets you free overnight shipping to the U.S. or Canada. I thank you, Eero, for making a Wi-Fi that really works. No more. I hear screams, but it's a different kind. Hey, I'm playing here. Yeah, go to bed. We are such a techie household now. Lisa will text Michael, brush your teeth and go to bed. She sends him a text. It's crazy. I did wire up the house, you know, when the Amazon added the intercom feature to the Echo, where you could have you could say, Michael, go to bed through the Echo. But he's smart. He immediately unplugged his Echo. So we've had to find other means. Your kids aren't old enough yet, Georgia, are they, to have to do that?
I don't. They're not really old enough. We make sure that we restrict the amount of time that they're on technology. But when they're playing a video game on their phone, I will text them and say, you know, go grab this or get that. It's just so much to scream through the house.
Right.
No, and I'm too lazy to get up and actually walk. So, that's one of the cases.
My mother in the old days before the internet, she got tired of shouting dinner. So she got a bell. And she just would ring a bell. And now, anytime I hear a bell, I salivate.
A very Pavlovian.
The text messages are just a bell, just an electronic bell. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, basically, that's all it is. Should we stay? Well, let me do the Facebook thing. We have more security stuff to talk about. There's actually a ton of stuff to talk about. Jason Heiner is here. We've got, of course, Greg Farrow here and the wonderful Georgia Dow. And Georgia, I think you'd be proud of me. Maybe not. Last night, I finally had it. I read this story. By the way, we've reported on this. We've been reporting on this for over a year. Facebook, I've told people for more than a year, don't do Facebook quizzes because Facebook allows a quiz designer not only to get all the information about you because you took the quiz, but, and this is incredibly infuriating, they also allow the quiz designer to get information about your friends. Facebook says, well, wait a minute. No, we only allow that to improve. Let me see if I can find the stupid quote. We're only allowing collection of friends' data to improve user experience in the app. It can't be sold or used for advertising, except that's exactly what Cambridge Analytica did. And now we know for a fact, even though we've known this for a while, we now have a whistleblower who has told the story of how Cambridge Analytica basically stole 50 million Facebook profiles, got all the information they need. Cambridge Analytica is owned by the Robert Mercer family and was run at the time by Steve Bannon. And, of course, the information was intended to be used by Trump during the campaign, although I don't blame Cambridge Analytica as much as I blame Facebook for even allowing this to happen. And you probably could say that other campaigns had done the same thing. The whistleblower said that they, since early 2014, they built a system that would profile U.S. voters in order to target them with personalized political advertisements. We exploited Facebook to harvest millions of people's profiles and built models to exploit what we knew about them and target their inner demons. This was the basis the entire company was built on.
You know, it's funny because Dan Patterson, who writes for me, was on this story in August of 2016. He was one of the first to write about this. And he was on it from when Ted Cruz's campaign were using Cambridge Analytica. And he was saying that there's just something fishy about this and it doesn't smell right. And it's amazing that we just didn't pay attention, that enough people did not pay attention to this.
I was up in Orange a year ago. The Observer, which broke this story, saw the documents, and this was confirmed by a Facebook statement that said that by late 2015, Facebook knew that this information had been harvested on an unprecedented scale. It did not alert users. It took only limited steps to recover and secure the private information. And in fact, this really frustrates me. When Facebook was told by the Observer that we have this information, we're going to go live with a story tomorrow, then and only then they kicked Cambridge Analytica off the platform.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
They knew. Like they knew.
They knew for years.
And really did nothing. It was completely a cover-up of everything that was happening to that. And the thing is that no company can police itself. We need to have legislation that's in place. I'm sorry. Yes, legislation, government, I hear you. But no one can police themselves.
The problem is, I agree with you 100%, Georgia, but Facebook's a black box to Congress and to regulators.
It can't be, right? It can't be.
How do you get that information if they don't want to give it?
Well, if they want to operate in the United States, they're going to have to be able to let people know how something's run. What is the information going to be used for? Their EULAs have to be something that's readable to mm-hmm. everyone that's going to be able to deal with it. And people, we have to reinstate educating people that work in the government about technology, which, you know, we've ended up defunding.
So why doesn't Facebook just relocate to the Philippines? They're already in tight with the Philippine president. We've already seen accusations leveled at Facebook saying that they are actively supporting the regime of Duterte over there, who's
horrible.
I don't want to get too carried away, but carrying out terrible things against the citizens. So Facebook could just up from Silicon Valley and relocate to the Philippines and continue on, and the U.S. government has effectively zero control, right?
Yeah, it's true. Like, the thing is, there are three companies right now that are disrupting markets, that are turning society upside down in so many ways. And it's because they are 5 to 10 years ahead of everybody else on data, and they know more about us than we know about ourselves, and they're using that data to monetize the living crap, you know, out of everything that they have. And they are incented to keep that as private and as proprietary as possible, because it's a gold mine, right? It's an absolute gold mine.
Their incentive to keep it to themselves, because if they give it away, they lose control. Somebody else can monetize. So the thing here is that I'm willing to bet a substantial sum of money that the executives inside of Facebook are mega pissed that someone else is making money from their data. Right?
That's true. The problem with Cambridge Analytica.
They're not making that much.
You're supposed to buy that from us. What do you get? Dude. Exactly. And the thing that frustrates me is I don't take Facebook quizzes, because I know that gives them your information. That's right. You know, you see these quizzes. Which Game of Thrones character are you? Are you smarter than a fifth grader? How's your spelling? And I see so many people on my timeline saying, see how smart I am? I'm in the 99th percentile in spelling. I'm saying, you're not smart. You're a moron. You just took that quiz. That was a dopey quiz. That was made up quiz. They just wanted your personal information. But you know what really frosts me is, I don't take the quiz. Doesn't matter. My friends did. They got my information. Yeah. And that's infuriating.
It's true. It was like 270,000 people downloaded the app, and 500 million people's information is out there. Yeah. So that's a huge amount of people that did not do it. And you're still, because you're part of the ecosystem, in the end, the only thing that matters to Facebook is if you delete Facebook and ask them to delete all the data that they have on you, because they're going to keep it anyways. And in the end, the amount of media literacy that we teach to our children and to ourselves, like we are so easily sucked into these applications for internet points that it's pretty sad.
The good news is, thanks to the EU and the GDPR, Facebook now has a way to actually permanently delete your information. In the past, when you got off of Facebook, they would deactivate your account for 6 months, hoping that you would at some point accidentally log in and they go, oh, welcome back. By the way, when you leave Facebook, I should have done this on the air because it's hysterical. They put pictures of all your friends and they look sad and they say, it literally said, Georgia Dow is so sorry you're leaving Facebook. Do you want to send her a note telling her why? It's the most offensive
emotional blackmail.
MG. So now you can do a complete delete of your Facebook data. And I really think this is because coming in May, they were going to get in trouble with the EU if they didn't offer this. So it's not just deactivating. It does still take 2 weeks. So last night, and I see here Facebook saying it'll take 90 days to delete all the things you've posted. Well, we'll see. Why would it take 90 days? Aren't computers a little faster?
They're hoping you're going to come back.
Right.
Caches.
It's not just the data that's in the primary system, but to do a complete deletion, you have to reach into all of the backups.
Well, I hope they do this. I said this is it. The only way to really punish Facebook, yes, they should be regulated. Mm-hmm. Yes, you know, Mark Warner's Honest Ads bill should go through, and that should require that, just as on radio and TV, political ads, have to be identified. You have to say this ad was paid for by so-and-so. That's not a requirement in digital advertising. It should be. That, I hope, happens. But it's still not going to – don't we know Mark Zuckerberg well enough by now? That's not going to stop.
Are we ever going to see an adult in charge of these companies, like an actual grown-up instead of these overblown teenagers that actually
are
sort
grown-ups
of
really are so better?
He's a grown-up. He's maximizing revenue. This is a grown-up who's become one of the richest men in the world. That's a grown-up.
Grown-ups are no better. Grown-ups are no better. In the end, any of these companies, all they want to do is make money. And I get it. But we have to make sure that we
I don't even blame Facebook or the engineers. They're doing what, you know, this is capitalism. They're doing what they have a fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders to do, maximize profit. They're supposed to do it legally. Okay, honestly, that's probably not right, but they're not completely legal, but they're trying their best to be sort of quasi legal. But they're maximizing profit. That's fine. So instead of saying let's regulate them, I'm going to vote with my feet. And by the way, this is not the first time I've quit Facebook, but this is the last time. I'm never going
remember,
back.
Though. I'm going to remember, Leo.
No,
I'm
never
remember.
Going back.
When you go back to Facebook, I'm going to be like,
I don't think I'm alone in this. We learned Facebook even said that 2 million fewer users under 18 in the past year. I think this is the beginning of an exodus. And I really believe this might be the final straw for a lot of users.
I don't know. But the thing is, the story is the data. The data is the story, right? It's not Cambridge Analytica is not making that much money. They were able to do this because of what Facebook has and the data that they have. And that data is a gold mine. Data is the new oil. Data is where the money is. And like I said, there's three companies that are so far ahead of everybody else. Google. Amazon.
And Facebook.
And Alibaba. So much. No, there's a bunch of others. Tencent, Alibaba. You're forgetting the rest of the world.
Get ready. There's going to be a million. WeChat. There's going to be a million.
Tencent are amazing. And they're ahead. But in terms of, you know, global reach, right, they're still so focused on the Chinese market that, they will eventually be global companies, but they aren't currently. But those three companies because they have very, very close relationships with their government, they're a bit protected for the moment. But those three companies that I mentioned, they have really been able to run roughshod over the entire globe with the exception of the EU and basically be able to do whatever they want with all this data and be have no transparency about what they're doing. And that's the problem. Cambridge Analytica, you know, is just like a gnat was able to use this platform to siphon a little bit off, right? The real problem, the real issue is the data and the fact that we have no regulation about it. And we're getting later and later in the game. And the EU and GDPR is making a difference because these companies, as well as a lot of others, you know, they essentially are making that their baseline. If they're going to have to do that there, then, you know, in Europe to be in that market, then it is having an effect on what they're doing in other markets as well, because it's just less expensive for them to get back to fiduciary responsibility. But, you know, we still have this huge problem that we just haven't woken up to the fact that, you know, that data is the new oil. And we can't let it be the wild, wild west.
Yeah. And even if they're operating somewhere else, if you put legislation in place that if you're operating here as well, which they want to, and the states is a huge area for them. So then they'll end up like, you know, falling into line. And we need to, in the end, what we need, though, is like media literacy. Like we need to teach our kids how to deal with social media, what's happening with it and why. And I think that, you know, old data is worth nothing. And old is like a really short period of time when we talk about the technological age. So if a lot of people, if there's an exodus from Facebook, which, you know, I don't use Facebook, so I think that would be great. But most of the young kids, they're still using other sets of social media. And our brains are primed for wanting to get those clicks on social media. That validation is going less and less with real people and more with internet clicks. And we're primed for that.
I have to say that it's easy to leave Facebook these days because it's not that compelling, to be honest. and if you're going to leave Facebook, you should also leave Facebook's WhatsApp and Instagram as well. But I haven't left Google and I haven't left Amazon. And that'd be a lot harder to leave Google, right?
Yeah.
What am I going to do?
DuckDuckGo is sad. DuckDuckGo, I use it. It's sad. I'm just going to say it.
It's hard. Sad. And I would have to give up Gmail. I would have to give up a lot of things. I actually did move my main mail account off Gmail. I used to use Gmail. I don't anymore. But it's a lot harder. It's easy to leave Facebook. So I'm putting a stake in the sand here, but I admit it's challenging. And I still buy a ton of stuff from Amazon. And Amazon arguably has more real data on me than Facebook did because they know everything I purchase. They have microphones in my house.
Yeah, but Amazon, Google. I think this the elephant in the room here is the political angle, and we haven't touched on that. The simple fact is that the data that Facebook let their partners, because these were signed up, legally obligated partners who promised not to steal the data, but they stole the data anyway, highlights the fact that Facebook has very little control over its data, had very little, and even now has.
I agree.
Once you're a Facebook employee, you can basically do anything you like. And the only reason we haven't seen more of this is just sheer blind luck.
Facebook seems to me to be more blatant than any other of these other companies.
It's stupid. It is the most stupid technology company. Google is not being caught up in politics. Amazon is not being caught up in politics. Facebook consistently makes horrendous unforced errors in the face of every political situation. So every time something comes out about Russia, Facebook says, no, no, not us, not us. And then somebody comes up with the evidence and say, oh, yeah, you got us. And then it goes through again.
So
and
frustrating.
Yeah,
So, Greg, you're saying that them asking for all the information to be destroyed wasn't enough for them to do? Because they just asked, and then they were okay with it. They said that they did.
There's nothing they can do. All they can do is legally say, yeah, you have to agree and sign an agreement. And if they find out later on, then they can sue, blah, 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 blah. But the horse has got the gate's open. The horse is gone. But the real issue here is that Cambridge Analytica was a UK company funded by alt-right, run by Steve Bannon, which is in Trump's government. The whole alt-right got involved in the Brexit thing here in the UK. We've now got the Information Commissioner's Office in the UK announcing that they will open an investigation into this whole issue. So Facebook is now under fire. You're talking about the right wing of the American government is now looking at Facebook going, are you with us or are you against us?
Whoa,
then you've got
scary.
Cambridge Analytica getting onto the right wing over here, and they're using
Duterte,
it, and they're trying to say,
this is scary.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want to create an authoritarian regime, Facebook's your best friend.
And that's exactly what they've done in the Philippines under Duterte. Same thing in Myanmar. Same thing's happening in many other countries. Facebook has been co-opted by governments, strongman governments, to control the population and to control the flow of information. And there's no reason for Facebook to stay in the U.S. It could just bunk out at any time, except for the fact that the U.S. is the market which generates the most revenue for them. But they could probably just scoot off if they needed to, if they thought the pressure. And they're childish enough. I mean, your average Silicon Valley executive has the mental brain power of a 16-year-old with a lot of hormones. They're so competitive. They're so inwardly looking. They're so focused on, winning. They're not focused on the money as much as they are on the winning. They're socially incompetent to the level where I'm winning if I'm making more money.
Right.
And so they're not actually following capitalism. They're not following any rules of society. They're just trying to win blindly, aggressively, over and over and over. Win, win, win. And the way that I keep score about winning is to make more money. And at some point, that's going to come off the rails because there's no more money to make, I suspect, or something else happens.
So just to play devil's advocate here, I do think that to a degree, Mark Zuckerberg's aware of the problem. And I think you've seen him the last couple years in pretty clear some statements knowing that like this thing has gotten out of control and he knows there's some serious problems. I mean, his number one, like his New Year's resolution, right, for this year was fix Facebook. Like that's a pretty bold statement. That's basically telling everybody, including your shareholders, that something's broken. And needs to be fixed.
Yeah, only that after someone shoved his face right into it. He didn't work it out for himself. Somebody had to slam his face into the desk and go, look, bang, bang, bang. His head got slammed into the desk 10, 12, 14 times before he went, oh, yeah, there's a problem.
No doubt. But he did admit it. He didn't just, he wasn't just blathering
so
on
he
about.
He says fix it, but I'd be interested to see what he's actually doing to fix it. You know, the latest thing is Facebook told CNN, oh, it was a rogue employee. We figured out it was a rogue employee that gave up all that information. So it wasn't our fault. My real problem is that if you're a normal person using Facebook, It's a very attractive thing. It's how you stay in touch with family and friends. You discover your high school sweetheart and what she's been up to. It's very attractive. Facebook acts as if you're giving them information, but they're keeping it private. You have control of it. You say who's a friend, who's an acquaintance, who is not to see your stuff. They really act as if, you know, you are controlling that information. They don't tell people that when you take a quiz, you're giving all your information to that company and you're giving up all your friends. I mean, you're
Facebook doesn't do it.
They don't tell you that.
They don't do it anymore because they realize that giving away the data meant other people were making money off Facebook's platform.
Oh, they don't. They don't do that third parties.
No, I don't think so.
They do still. You can check it on or off if you choose, but people usually don't even read that or know what they're doing. I think that, you know, I would love to think that Zuckerberg is actually, you know, wants to fix Facebook, because who knows what that means. But the best way to tell if someone's behavior in the future is by their behavior in the past. And they waited 2 years to be able to deal with this. They were not transparent about it. They only deleted them from their system when they found out. And the information was still there anyways. So we know that in the end, their most important thing was Facebook and keep saving face and making the most amount of money. So no, I don't think that they really want to make a difference in the world or try to do the right thing. I think that they'll only do that if they have to, or if it ends up hurting their bottom line by people deleting Facebook. And in the end, that's really, like, legislation I think is important, but I think that you're right, Leo, that, you know, deleting Facebook is the biggest message that you could send to them. And if there's a huge exodus, they'll start to listen.
My point was that I think Zuckerberg realizes there's a problem, but at this point, I'm not sure even what he could do.
Yeah, exactly.
But do you think that he cares, or does he care because it's going to hurt his bottom line economically?
No, I think he cares because of that, but he's also Bill Gates territory, right?
If he cared,
right?
He'd have done something by now.
Not.
He owns the company outright. He has full control. All the voting stock exists in his pocket. If he wanted to do something, it would be done. Remember what happened in 2015 when he said, you know what, now we're going to make money. We're going to make money out of mobile ads. We're going to make money out of desktop ads. And guess how quickly they brought ads online?
Yeah.
9 months before they were turned loss-making to profits.
This is a much more difficult problem than making ads off of mobile, though.
It's a huge problem because your business model is intertwined with this lack of privacy. I mean, that's the whole business model.
What he would have to do is kind of what I'm getting to, is he would have to be transparent about the way they're handling data, which is what they need to do. That's what I would recommend that they do, not because it's going to make them a lot more money. They don't. The thing is a cash cow.
It's the right thing to do.
But it's the right thing to do, and it is ultimately going
to
be
only the right thing to do in the U.S.
Behavior.
What are you going to do in the Philippines? What are you going to do in Burma? What are you going to do in Australia or China? What are you going to do in the U.K.?
Look what's happening
Europe?
In China. I mean, I really
–
China has now said – that this is so Black Mirror, I'm stunned. I didn't know this, but China has a social credit system that you can gain or lose social credit depending on how you behave. And if your social credit gets low enough, they're not going to let you on a plane or a train. You won't be able to travel.
It's like the anti-troll mechanism.
Yeah.
A government-branded anti-troll.
If you spread false – and this is – remember, the Chinese government – is defining this. If you spread false information about terrorism, what does that mean? Maybe you say something bad about President Xi. I don't know. Cause trouble on flights. If you used an expired ticket or you smoke on a train, you can lose social credit and be banned.
Well, smoking on a train, I'm in favor of that.
I know. That one's not so bad.
You should never get...
This is just part of a whole bunch of new things in China. The police are now wearing face recognition cameras. And there seems to be, I'm not really sure about this because I'm not an expert on the Chinese people, but there seems to be a generalized acceptance that, well, if we have a more orderly society, it's okay if we, you know, have a social credit ranking and we ban people with low credit from the trains. It feels very Black Mirror to me. And I really feel like, if you want to watch what's really going to happen or what could happen, watch what's happening in China now. It's not human rights.
Yeah, it's different, though. I mean, I think that as culturally they have such a hatred of violence and of social unrest.
I know. They seem to be embracing it culturally.
Whereas I think you have – you have such a different cultural mindset, you know, in the US. I mean, we can't even agree to have background checks so people can't get, you know, semi-automatic weapons to shoot, you know.
No, we're the exact opposite, people. Aren't we? Actually,
that's right, right? I mean,
that's a good point. Sometimes that's not such a bad thing, you know, freedom.
I don't know. The need to be forced into conformity can become a really dangerous thing. And if you look on Facebook or on Twitter or on Snapchat, people are trying to get as much internet credits already as they have. And if you have more followers, you're a better person than I am. And I feel
we have an unofficial social credit system, don't we?
We do. And it works really well. We are hardwired. Our brains are hardwired to want other people to validate us, to socially validate us. And we love getting treats and perks because we're a better person than someone else is. If you take a look at, you know, I have a more expensive phone than you do. I have a better car than you do. I, you know, have the winning team that's the one that's my team versus your team. Tribalism is strongly inclined to us and was one of the things that helped us survive as a people. But now it can be used against us in a way to control our behavior and also for governments to be able to censure and sanction on people that are doing things that they don't want. It works almost implicitly, like too well. And because of that, it can be really dangerous.
Well said.
I don't know about you, but I'm terrified of people who've got guns. You know, I mean, you know, the idea you're worried about people not being allowed on trains because they've been bad people. I'm just terrified walking down the street in America knowing that people are allowed to have guns. Some of those people are nuts.
Do you actually feel when you come to the States? You live in the UK, we should say. You're Australian. Australia has a really interesting story. There was a terrible mass shooting. Was that in Tasmania, I think?
Yes, he went into a theme park fundamentally and shot up 196 people, killed them, and walked around for 8 hours killing people hour after hour.
And the Australian government decided, that's it. We're not going to do it anymore. They changed the laws, but they also did a massive gun buyback, which was very successful. They took millions of guns out of circulation, and there hasn't been another mass shooting since.
Now, if you're an American, though.
Their crime level in Australia went down starkly. They're now higher than Canada is for safety.
Isn't that interesting?
And Canada's in the top 10.
Yeah.
Now, so here's what an American would say, though. That's great as long as you've got really good government that you trust.
Yeah, but I got to be honest with you.
But you can't fight the government.
I got to be honest with you.
Do you believe that you can fight the government?
They have tanks. AR-15s you want.
There's no way you could fight the government anyways.
They've got cruise missiles.
I'm not advocating that point of view, you guys. I'm just saying this is the way Americans' mindset, that's the first place your mindset goes.
This is the way the political system's been hijacked by organizations such as the NRA to distort the debate politically. And I suspect that it's a significant amount of money. Maybe we should move the conversation to talking about how politics and money in the Broadcom versus Qualcomm discussion, Leo.
I would love to get to that. We will in just a second. That's an interesting one, too. You know, President Trump took credit for nixing that acquisition, but it turns out it wasn't. It's a part of the U.S. government that's not widely known. We'll talk about that in just a second. We had a great week this week. I hope you saw some of our shows. If you didn't, don't worry, because we've actually created a short movie for your enjoyment. Some of the things you missed this week on Twit.
Previously on Twit.
So does this look like me?
That does look like you.
It actually looks like Mike Elegant.
Well, that's actually a compliment. I'll take it. You can change it. Oh, God, I'm wearing yellow shorts. Oh, you're so cheerful.
Aww. Yeah, it's just like me.
The new Screensavers.
Our very own Jason Howell and producer went down to San Francisco to check out the Nano Fair. It's a tiny, tiny little fair.
You can go a range of 10 miles on a single battery charge.
Hey, it works. Not bad.
Triangulation.
Anna Lee Newitz is my guest. Her new book is Autonomous, and I want to point out right away that this is not that book. It's not utopian, but you wouldn't say it's dystopian either, right?
It's topian. You know,
it's topian.
Yeah, it's the future where
it's something. The future. You know, it's a mixed bag.
Twit, the happiest place on earth.
For those of you listening,
build your own vibrator.
Jason has approached a booth at the Nano Fair.
Jason!
That he decided, he declined.
Well, guess what? There's part two of this coming up later.
To interview.
Will he or won't he?
The build your own vibrator people. which segues right into our first ad this week. Actually, I guess it's our second ad this week. And I don't know how to do this, but maybe you can, maybe Georgia Dow, you're a psychotherapist. Maybe you can help me with this. Or maybe you just want to keep your hands off. Men's health is a topic that we're not good. Men are not good about talking about health issues, right? And there's one issue that we will just not bring up at all. You don't want to tell your doctor. You don't want to tell your friends. You definitely don't want to tell your wife. Erectile dysfunction, right? This is something that people are just nervous about. But you don't have to live with it because there's Roman, a men's health company that will do remote, online, completely private diagnosis for ED and then offer convenient monthly delivery of medication. Now, don't be embarrassed, guys. It's okay. This is going to help you. Guys don't like talking about this, but there's no reason to ignore it. All it takes is 5 minutes. You'll do an online survey about your medical history. You can give your preferences of medication, too, if you've got a preference. Roman handles everything from online diagnosis to prescription delivery for ED meds. U.S. licensed physicians will review the treatment request within 2 hours. And if appropriate, if it's not a harmful situation, they will write a prescription for you, and then the medication is delivered free to your door. This is not one of those phony online pharmacies. This is a real pharmacy, Roman Pharmacy, discreetly packaged with RHP on the front. Refills happen automatically every month or every quarter. I know you don't want to talk about this to your buddies. You don't want to talk about it to your doctor, but Roman's a place to start. $50 off your first month. Try it. Look at there. The nice lady, Dr. Jocelyn. I would trust her. Dr. Pepper. That's a real name? Dr. Pepper and Dr. Steven. I want Dr. Pepper. Can I have Dr. Pepper? We'll review and prescribe at GetRoman.com/twit. GetRoman.com/twit. When they approached us, everybody said, you shouldn't do this. I said, no, wait a minute. I think we should do this ad. I think this is something people should talk about. You shouldn't be embarrassed to talk about this.
We shouldn't. We're horrible here about body functions.
Yeah.
We really are. And that's really a North American thing. It's a North American thing. You know, if you go down to Europe and other places, people are so much more open about talking about body functions. Often people will wait a really long time before they tell me about something about their body that's not working right. And unfortunately, our bodies...
You're a doctor. You know, you're an MFT. You're here to get help.
Yeah. And we all have stuff.
And erectile dysfunction is a horrible thing to have happen, especially, you know, you have a loved person in your life and you want to be functional. And this is a good thing. That's all. Thank you, Puritans, for making this all messy. Screwing it up for all of us. All right, let's talk. So Qualcomm, San Diego company, U.S. founded, U.S. run. Of course, they own pretty much every patent for CDMA. They own many LTE patents. That's a very profitable part of their business. They also do chip designs, and Qualcomm chips are in almost every smartphone made. Recently, Apple's been trying to pull back from Qualcomm by using Intel chips, but they weren't as good. So they really, this is a good business. Broadcom, also chip manufacturer, used to be in the U.S. They went to Singapore, right?
Yeah,
it sounds like, Greg, you're up on this, so I'm going to let you take it from here. They made an offer to buy Qualcomm.
Yep.
Was it a hostile takeover?
Yes, it was hostile. Qualcomm doesn't want to be acquired. They're looking for a much higher price. Broadcom offered $60. Qualcomm wants $90.
Okay.
Which is kind of like a big, you know, two fingers telling you that you're really going to. That's a way, 50% up. Is a very big ask. The game's been going backwards and forwards. If you go back a little bit, let's get some history here. Broadcom was originally a substantial part of Broadcom was the old Bell Labs.
So there's a business called Avago,
which is the silicon part of HP and before that Compaq and Dell and blah, blah, blah. And so a substantial part of Broadcom's portfolio is a U.S. business that then moved to Singapore.
Our studios are in an old Broadcom building, and Broadcom's still next door, actually.
Yeah. So Avago and the progenitors or the core of the Avago acquisition that was part of a merger just a couple of years ago, it is still a U.S. business. So the bulk of Broadcom's revenue and business still exists in the U.S., although the company is now domiciled in Singapore. They've wanted to repatriate, though.
They want to come back, right?
Well, they went and spoke to President Trump. They did a deal, got some great press, and then announced that they're relocating back to the U.S. President Trump you know, used that to say he's great. It's going to be great for jobs, you know, U.S. businesses and all that sort of thing.
I remember that press conference.
Right. And so part of it that is the logic here is that Broadcom then took that opportunity to make another acquisition, so to take over Qualcomm. So what we're looking at here is the market for chips is starting to stagnate. There's the innovation pace is slowing down. So one way to make the to keep your profits growing is to start acquiring your competitors and get big, go into scale, get large as quickly as possible so that you own the most market share and you can potentially grab a dominant market and then control the market to your benefit. So Broadcom wants to buy Qualcomm. Qualcomm doesn't want to be acquired. Qualcomm goes to the long and short of it is that Qualcomm did a whole bunch of moves. Broadcom made moves to be appointed to the Qualcomm board. And then all of a sudden we see President Trump come out and say he's decided to kill the Qualcomm announcement. Now, in the meantime, Qualcomm is spent over $100 million in Washington in lobbyist fees over the last 12 months. So Qualcomm has a long history of buying lobbyists in Washington to support its business. So a big part about what it spends its money on is just related to protecting its patents. So if you have a large patent portfolio, you need politicians and political support to make sure that your portfolio doesn't get scuppered in some way, to make sure the legal protections are in place. Broadcom failed to recognize that Qualcomm has a number of supporters in government, literally due to how much money it pays politicians. And Qualcomm has had a long history, a 20 or 30 year history of using the US government to prop up its profits. That is, it might get the US government to mandate the use of US technology, which just so happens to be Qualcomm only technology, like CDMA.
Right.
So the reason that Qualcomm CDMA was forced onto Verizon was that the US government said, we want one carrier to be using 3G and we want one carrier to be using CDMA, two technologies, so if one fails, and the CDMA must be from Qualcomm because that's a UK company, blah, 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 blah. And in the end, of course, Verizon got stung. They went out. They wasted tens of billions of dollars going down a technology path that nobody wanted, because the only country in the world to deploy CDMA was, but Qualcomm made out like bandits, right? They made billions and billions out of licensing.
Doesn't Japan use CDMA as well?
China used some CDMA, okay. A different band, but okay. Yeah.
Yeah, but LTE is the winner in all of this in the future. And, in fact, even Verizon's moving to LTE.
Well, 4G LTE and ultimately 5G will have a much wider range of choices.
So it wasn't it's very much a political fight. It was CFIUS, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S., that technically made this decision. But it sounds to me like your contention, Greg, is that this is just another example of lobbying on Qualcomm's part.
That's my understanding. Qualcomm spent a lot of money and has had a long history of getting political decisions to go its way. It was able to go to CFIUS, as you say, get it, and then that went to President Trump, who was then able to claim the victory as his own, protecting U.S. jobs. I think there are some valid
Well, that's my real question, and I include Jason in this as well, is, and I've seen a number of articles saying, well, we don't like how it went down, but you know what? It wasn't a bad thing to prevent Broadcom from buying Qualcomm.
I mean, it wasn't a great hostile takeover. Broadcom is one of those weird companies. Greg characterized it perfectly. There is much of like almost like a standards organization, a portfolio company, than really somebody that makes something. They're one of those companies that has a lot of IP, but they're
is this Qualcomm or Broadcom?
Sorry, Broadcom.
Qualcomm
actually makes things.
Okay.
Really.
I think it's the other way around. Don't I have Broadcom chips in all of my stuff?
No, Broadcom makes chips. Qualcomm is mostly just an IP.
They have two branches, but most of their revenue comes from IP.
Qualcomm does make chips, but Broadcom's core business is chip design and manufacture.
Right.
Qualcomm is about creating the technology and then licensing it.
I guess I'm splitting hairs, but I think of it more the other way around. You know, on everything that I know of the two companies. But the point is that what the White House is talking about is all optics. I don't think this is not going to change any job from being in Singapore, which is the one.
Was
place
that
in
the issue? World. Jobs or security?
Well, it's both, right?
We don't want a non-U.S. company making the fundamental technologies in our smartphones.
Singapore has a close relationship with China, right? So there's a little bit of
Singapore is an ally of the United States
as
well. right?
100% yeah. UK protectorate for a long time, right? And all that. Right.
It's very confusing for...
So the point is, it's optics, right? Yeah. It's one of those things. It was easy to go to the president for the organization, right? To go to the president for CFIUS and say, we're not going to do this. We shouldn't do this because it looks like a hostile takeover of a U.S. company by an international company in Asia. Yep. And so that's why they did it from optics. They're both very well positioned in Washington. They both are, you know, are companies that make chips, but really they make more money off the licensing of patents that they own. They're not companies that are, you know, big employers necessarily. And somebody like, you know, Intel and Samsung that are, you know, employing lots and lots of people that are, you know, building the next generation.
Of late, Broadcom has been more about investment and portfolio acquisition than any real technology company, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And the other part about this is the rise of Huawei and ZTE as networking makers, and they're pushing very hard into the telco market. So the U.S. market is largely closed to these Chinese companies, and Broadcom makes the chips that companies like Huawei and ZTE and others can use to put in. And the U.S. security apparatus is very concerned that they may end up where all the chips are designed by an international company, probably based in – they don't see Broadcom necessarily as a viable owner of that. And they would also feel that they may end up beholden to Huawei providing the technology that would run – the mobile phone networks in the U.S.
5G is going to be primarily Huawei, right?
Yes. Well,
not
primarily. It's a very wide spectrum. Nokia, Ericsson, Cisco's trying to get in there. Qualcomm's got a lot of the patents around some of the 5G stuff. Well, they're trying to get their patents into the 5G portfolio so they can get revenue.
Yeah, because they have a problem because their CDMA patents are going to be worthless soon enough.
Yeah, some of them are fundamental. It's very complicated because there's thousands of them.
And, of course, Apple and Qualcomm are in a vicious fight over patent royalties.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're looking at, for example, Broadcom is currently, it's wired infrastructure, so it does a lot of Ethernet chips today. So it's ASIC engines for Ethernet. It's one of its biggest divisions, $1.8 billion. All the chips in your Wi-Fi base stations are all Broadcom.
Is it silly to worry then about security from chips made in China or Chinese-related countries like Singapore? I mean, should we?
It's rational.
Is it rational? It's something we should.
It is logically rational, but I do think it's practically silly. The chances of putting something.
There's going to be a Chinese chip in almost anything you use.
That's where it's going now anyways, that most things are going to be made there because it's so much more affordable for companies
to be able
to
manufacture. Well, but there's a difference between like using an iPhone, which is manufactured in China, but under the, I would hope, tight control of Apple. I'm sure they test chips before they use them in the phone and so forth. And a Chinese company like Huawei or ZTE or Xiaomi, where it's at least partially owned by the Chinese military.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a difference there. I think you could trust an iPhone where you may not trust a Xiaomi phone. I don't know. I want a Xiaomi phone, so I don't know.
I think it's rational to ask the question. It's practically silly because
you can't do it.
We are not in a position to to rationally evaluate that because chips are so phenomenally complicated.
Right.
But I think let's assume that for whatever reason, Qualcomm has decided to take a position to oppose the Broadcom board. And if you believe the proposition that I've put forward, which is that they've politically been able to work faster than Broadcom and outclass them at that level.
So it really was just lobbying. All of it was just lobbying.
Well, the interesting question now is we've seen Intel in a great deal of trouble. Does Intel now make a play for Qualcomm to get large and to compete with Broadcom?
Yeah.
And if so, does the U.S. government now actively support an Intel buyer?
You have to kind of hope not, even though, like we said, like Qualcomm and Broadcom, I know they do make chips. It's the smaller chips. It's the networking, you know, chips.
Yeah, but it's critical infrastructure. I mean, we know of problems, security issues with the baseband radio. And I mean, this is fairly critical infrastructure. If every phone in the country is hackable.
Right.
That's a problem.
I mean, that's obviously
but
a problem.
Every phone in the nation is hackable.
I know.
So, right, already.
It has been for years.
But, But I think that what we have to worry about is, you know, is the fact that these companies, you know, like with Intel buying Qualcomm, if we get that kind of vertical integration, then that's almost always a bad thing for consumers. It almost always means higher prices. It almost always is something, whether it was Broadcom or Intel buying them, you know, the friction between x86 and the ARM processors has been a good thing for consumers. It's been a good thing for processors. Now, it could be that, you know, every company and every technology runs its course. And so it could be that Qualcomm, you know, is a target because, you know, that they're sort of, they've kind of run their course. And, you know, Broadcom, Intel, maybe it wouldn't matter. But I do worry that, you know, that competitive pressure is what's helping keep technology, the cost of it, lower. And so we'll see.
So I'm curious if anybody knows, Georgia and I were, I think, referring to the hack, the SS7 hack that we learned about 2 years ago. As far as I know, has not been mitigated. Greg, do you know if this is the software that's used in the radios in all of our phones, right?
Yeah.
Can't be mitigated.
It can't
be mitigated.
So no. It's there. Yeah. There's nothing, yeah. And there's nothing there. You could do about it.
No. That's why people are saying, you know how we're reaching the SMS messages that they send us are all triggered over SS7 signaling. And this is why people are calling for the end of SMS messages with the, you know, how you get PayPal and they'll send you a text message with a PIN number.
Yeah, that's a terrible way to do it. Yeah.
Because SS7 is inherently insecure, it's a 30-year-old technology. It was never designed to be secure. It was always assumed that the network was secure and therefore the protocol didn't need to be encrypted or safe. And there's nothing they can do about it short of replacing it, but there's no momentum to replace it because there's no money in voice.
So SS7 would allow a hacker to send, read, forward, intercept text messages, but apparently you could do the same with calls as well,
yes.
Right? You mm-hmm. could track the yep. location of a phone. You can, I mean, this is, and this has been around, we've known about this for years. So what are we worried about Broadcom freaking Qualcomm?
Well, the trick is to get into the SS7 signaling, you've got to be attached to a network where the signaling is. And normally those networks are secured and safe. And what we're finding increasingly is that the telcos who are in charge of those networks are no longer being safe. They're no longer spending money on security or maintaining those because the voice network, it doesn't generate revenue for them. So they're pushing it away to go and work on data or, you know, or like Verizon, they go and buy Yahoo and media companies and so forth to try and make money. And the voice network is fundamentally being abandoned because it's not a profit center for them.
You remember watching 60 Minutes where they surveilled a congressman using using an SS7 hack. And you're telling me it can't be fixed.
I mean, Firefox NX in the chat room said it best. SS7 is a feature. It's not a bug. Like, it's been around forever. And it's until you replace that, you know, that infrastructure, the protocol, right, then it's
I
not.
I almost get the
and
feeling that
there's no momentum for that.
There's a lot of entrenched entities that would prefer we just don't talk about this.
Right. SS7, I mean, the trick is you've got to
including
get
governmental agencies who would say, you know, let's just not let's downplay this SS7. Because have you heard anything about it in the last couple of years? Has it been
the
fixed?
The trick here is that it's a nation state level hack, really.
Right.
It's not something that ordinary,
right.
You know,
yeah.
I'm attached to the internet. SS7 doesn't usually travel over the internet.
Although we're seeing stingrays everywhere, right?
That's a different thing.
Although if you had a stingray, you could use an SS7 hack with the stingray, couldn't you? You
don't need an SS7 hack because you actually become a phone base station.
Because you're getting everything.
Yeah,
you've got all of the metadata there because all your data is flowing through the meta station and the 3GPP.
So we're screwed 100 different ways, basically.
Pretty much. So for now, it's mostly a nation state, and I think there's kind of like a cyber war that's happening behind the scenes around SS7 that we don't see.
That's what I think too. I think
the challenge here, of course, is that now that voice calls don't generate profits, there's no incentive here to fix that.
Right.
Yeah. And unlikely to be any. soon. Yeah.
Is this why Google wants to do RCS and stuff like that, or is that separate? Is that unrelated?
No, that's all to do with IoT. So there's a bunch of standards to do with RCS, LoRa, NB-IoT. They're three low-powered.
I thought RCS was their rich communications messaging that they want to.
Dead. RCS is dead. Nobody wants to have anything. really, what we're looking at is LoRa and NB-IoT. There's a big fight there to do sub, like old modem speed, like bits per second or hundred thousands of bits per second, so that a battery operated like a CR2032 battery, the size of a 50 pence piece. You know, those types of devices, and they should be able to run for like 10 years on that battery. But they'll be able to they just transmit little tiny bursts of like a temperature sensor, and it just basically once every 15 minutes wakes up and says 22 degrees, you know.
That's NB-IoT. And to think that it all started with this guy back in 1973, Steve Jobs. This was a resume, I don't know, a job application from Steve where he says he doesn't have a phone. When asked if he has access to transportation, he says possible but not probable. You could tell he was kind of a jerk even back then. Asked if he had any skills, typing, no. Machines, no. Key punch, no. Computer and calculator, yes. Design and tech, he's got a special ability. He wants to be electronics tech or design engineer for digital products. This job application from a teenaged Steve Jobs. He would have been 18 when he did this.
Probably not wearing any shoes at the same time.
Probably not wearing any shoes or deodorant.
Yeah.
Went for sale at auction for $174,757.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. It's a historian's dream right there.
Look at
that. It's a pretty awesome document.
I guess. Who do you think bought it?
I don't know. I think that's overpriced.
Hopefully a museum. Hopefully somebody like a museum or, you know, the Computer History Museum in Mountain View or somebody. I hope it was somebody like that or somebody that bought it and donated it to them.
I'll never forget going to, I think it was the Cleveland Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It might have been Seattle's Experience Music Center, but it was a great rock and roll museum. I think it was Cleveland. And I saw John Lennon's handwritten lyrics for In My Life.
Yeah.
And that's worth $127,000. I don't think this is worth $127,000.
Yeah. It's $175,000.
Hello, Silicon Valley. Stupid is as stupid does.
Yeah, it's got to be a you know, Peter Thiel type that bought this.
It's like $10,000 worth a letter.
I hope it ends up in a museum somewhere, though. That is kind of fun, right?
Because
the point is that it shows you could start out, you know, small, not really knowing what you're doing, not, you know, not having much of a clue, and you can eventually figure it out.
Yeah, I love it. Apple has announced they are going to have a March event. There were lots of rumors about a March event. The invites went out. They're kind of cool looking. Georgia, have you get one of these yet?
No, they don't invite me. Renee gets to enjoy all kinds of stuff.
You think you got one? I'll have to ask him on Tuesday. Let's take a field trip, it says. And kind of in a calligraphic illustration of an apple, join us to hear creative new ideas for teachers and students. It's going to be at a prep school in Chicago, Lane Tech College Prep High School in Chicago, March 27th, 10 a.m. Chicago time. We're going to be covering it live that Tuesday. We'll stream live 8 a.m. my time. And then go right into iOS today. What do you think, Georgia? What do you think Apple's going to announce?
Well, I think it's a wonderful thing of how to use Apple products in the classroom, how to deal with accessibility, how to help students be able to learn better and to be able to use Apple products. Because in the end, if once you learn a certain ecosphere, you end up staying on that ecosphere. You feel comfortable with it. So I think
Apple's
that Apple
needs famous
to
for
stay,
doing that. I mean,
yeah, well, that's what really brought back, right? Is being in the classroom. So right. I think that they're going back to that. And I think that there's a lot of push that we need to have our kids understand media and be able to handle it. And I think Apple wants to make sure that they're there at the forefront of it and don't lose ground to Google.
They are losing ground. Chromebooks have kind of dominated in the school.
Oh my God, they're
just so much more affordable. Schools, schools can't afford Apple products, totally. So Apple has to figure out how can they get them back into the school system. Because if you use that at school, then you're going to want to get that at home. It makes sense to that. And even though my kids don't use technology, they have
wait their a minute, own what?
They use technology. They have to pay for their own technology. They don't just get to run rampant on video games and have computers and
phones. How do they pay?
They end up paying by using good marks, getting good marks in classes, doing homework, doing things like that. So we end up, they do well in the school stuff, and then they end up getting to be able to use technology and play VR and do whatever else they want for it.
Mom and Dad have not one but two VR simulator rooms in the house.
Three now.
Three?
Yeah. We do have the PSVR set up as well, but,
I can just hear the conversation. Do you go to the kids? When you're a grown-up, you can have your own VR. Until then, you go to school.
We have our degrees. We've already done it. Luckily, they didn't have VR when we were kids, so we didn't have to worry.
That's right.
We learned all the social skills that we needed but kids are lacking in the ability. Like, the only problem with more tech in the classroom is that we already have kids that have an inability to be able to read emotions and understand body language and cues, and the amount of social anxiety is kind of skyrocketing.
Lisa's son, Michael, is going to take a class. Is that this fall, Lisa, or this summer, right? That's what the class is designed to teach you how to read people. Not in a negative, bad way, but so that you can see if somebody's, if you're getting cues from somebody that they're upset or they're happy, because
it's great.
Because most kids, he's like,
they don't. And it's weird. It's not implicit. We actually learn that through mimicry. So if our heads are stuck into a computer, or your parents' heads are stuck in their computers or on VR, then you're not learning how to read other people's cues. And I do that a lot in session, of helping people be able to read what does someone mean. Because I do have kids come in and they have no clue if someone's upset or annoyed or they've insulted someone. And most of body language, 80% of language, is through body language. And so you need to be able to do both. I think it's a great idea to have a class to that, but also we need to do that through personal interactions.
Do you think, is there
males
evidence?
Are particularly bad too. Yeah. Males are particularly myopic and closed off to it, and so have to work a little harder to overcome nature a little bit, right? To learn
there is a little bit, a little bit of that is actually biology, right? So men did go out and do more of the hunting and the fighting for things, and women usually, and again, this is a little bit of bias, people don't get angry to me, but it's true. Women did work in larger social groups where they were watching over the kids, and they had to foretell what these children were going to do wrong before they did it, so that they would survive and be able to read other women that they were working with. And so that was we're usually by and large better at it, but still I notice men and women right now, young adults, that are having difficulty with being able to read people, and because of that having a lot of social anxiety when they go into new events.
It might really explain a lot about the bro culture, an insensitivity to what, flame wars. It's one of the reasons Twitter becomes such this god-awful outrage engine. There's no social cues going on. And so you would have conversations on Twitter you would never have in real life.
Everybody said the same thing about television. They said the same thing about radio. They said the same thing about, if you go back to the 17th century.
Yeah, but it's true this time.
But it actually is true for even radio. It is actually true for radio and TV and for other things. We are not as good at delaying gratification.
TV,
but we're not as good at delaying gratification as we used to. Kids are now no longer ever able to be bored. It causes them a lot of distress in dealing with that. As with time, now that we have a more instantaneous reward system, our brains become more inclined to get more rewards more quickly. And we actually feel a sense of pain. It's not true pain, but a feeling of longing and sadness when we're not getting rewarded immediately. And we have a lot of overly reactive young adults now because they're kind of used to getting things immediately. And so, even though it's a smaller difference in between that, now that we do things that are instantaneous, I get upset if I can't, I used to have to get up and actually turn the channels of the TV. Now I don't even want to reach over if I can't find the Apple remote. I want to try to talk to my TV to be able to do it, and I get annoyed for that.
So if you get a Chromebook instead of a MacBook, you could have this instant sense of anger and anger. management that you have to deal with.
So I've got two teenage daughters. One's 20 and the other one's 16. One's 18 and one's 16. They have been through all of that, and they end up just building coping mechanisms just like I had to go through coping mechanisms of the era. I think that generally the challenge that we have at the moment is that people just haven't adapted to the new environment. So I don't subscribe to this apocalyptic, you know, world-ending view that, you know, we're rewiring our brains. Yes, we're rewiring our brains, but it's no different to the industrial age in the 18th century when people came off the land to work in factories. It's no different to when people started printing Bibles and the priests were saying, you can't give ordinary people Bibles. They have no way to interpret it. It's just a matter of working through it. Don't pretend it's a problem. It's just progress.
No, but you don't want to put your head in the sand and say everything that we do is okay just because we do it. You want to be able to open up your eyes and be able to see that whatever we do at every moment, yes, neurons fire together, they wire together. That's the way that we work. And if you're not going to learn a skill, you're not going to get better at it. If we never allowed our children to walk, they wouldn't learn how to. This is not something that doesn't happen without practice. So you want to be able to be knowledgeable to it. I love tech, but you want to be honest also with what are the pros and the cons to what you use.
I mean,
and
I think
the challenge here is
true.
That you're putting your values on tech. So
yeah.
So you know, one of the reasons that we opened up with talking about certifications, and I need to move past the things that I've done in the past instead of dragging them along behind me. I don't spend all my life attached to my phone. But you know what? I also don't have to put up with all the nasty people I used to work with, because some of those people were idiots.
Greg, right? we don't use that word anymore. That's
I almost spewed tea all over the screen.
Sorry.
Greg, you spend too much time looking at your phone.
So, I mean, the people that I used to work with are stupid. The companies I used to work with are inherently – any big company is inherently stupid. Right? Due to the blessings of technology, I don't have to put up with that life-threatening situation
anymore.
That's
a good point. There's pros and cons. Can we agree on that?
100%. Look, progress and egress they go hand in hand. And so there's things that we're moving backward on, and there's things that we're improving. And the thing is, in time, like, we're going to have to learn how to deal with whether it's Facebook, whether it's screen time, mobile devices. All of these things are inherently just tools. But we can also use those tools in the same way that humans can do everything for good or ill, right? We are still figuring out what those things are and creating the boundaries, which I think is what ultimately George is getting at, is, you know, we understanding those things and then figuring out where the boundaries are so that we can, you know, manage them to the best effect is the challenge that we're going through now, because things are moving so quickly that we're not having a whole lot of time to process it and to, you know, put up the kind of guidelines that we need to, you know, manage these things effectively.
You know what gave me hope just the other day? My daughter, who's 26, by the way, and did grow up through this whole technological era, but I think is very good at reading cues and emotions and stuff. She's really, really good at that. She called me up. She said, "Dad, I need to get an electric toothbrush. I feel I'm not brushing my teeth well enough." And I thought, hallelujah, how long have I been telling you that? So I ordered her this. I got her Quip. This is and I'm not kidding. I actually said, "Honey, I'll take care of it. I know exactly what to get you. This is the best electric toothbrush." I said, first of all, it doesn't plug in. You don't have to have a charger. She said, "Oh, I like that. It has a AAA battery in it." And so that means it runs for, I don't know how long. I haven't had to put a new battery in for a while. I think probably several months. And then you just put in a new battery. She liked that. It also has this great, I love this, little holder that has a stickum on the back of it. And you put that, somebody keeps taping this down for some reason. You put this on your mirror or wherever. I'll put it right here on you, Georgia, like that. And then you have it right there. You just pull it out. It's got all the things a good electric toothbrush needs. Like every 30 seconds, it says do another quadrant. So you get 2 minutes of brushing. It's actually got a great brush with very soft bristles. You don't, with an electric toothbrush, you don't want a hard bristle because it could actually wear away your enamel. It comes with very lovely toothpaste. It tastes phenomenal. And you won't believe how affordable it is. The Quip toothbrush starts at $25. For a very good electric toothbrush, I love
my quip. And now she's going to have very nice, shiny teeth and fresh breath, and her checkups are going to be phenomenal. Quip, backed by over 10,000 dental professionals. It'll even give you tips on oral care, things you never knew. I got this little Quip manual. For instance, you know this, Georgia, because you're a mom, but I don't know, maybe you don't. You know, you don't, after your brush, you don't want to rinse out your mouth. You want to leave the toothpaste in there for a while. Don't rinse right away. Did you know that?
You want to keep the fluoride.
Right.
You want to keep the fluoride, rinsing it off.
My whole life. Spit rinse after you brush, right? No, you're not supposed to. Thank you, Quip. You taught me something. You're supposed to wash, but not rinse. And then wash this off, but not rinse your mouth. It tells you to scrub your tongue. This is awesome. So, yes, you get a little dental education as well. Time Magazine's best invention of the year. Quip starts at just $25. And if you go to getquip, GETQUIP.com/twit, you get your first refill pack free when you purchase any Quip electric toothbrush. A variety of shades. She chose the green. I said, what color do you want? I can't remember. It was like red, silver. She chose the green. You get your first refill pack free when you purchase a Quip electric toothbrush at our website, getquip, GETQUIP.com/twit. And this is, I just felt like this is a big step forward in adulting for my daughter. You know what I mean? You know what I mean, Greg. I totally know what I mean. She's adulting.
I totally know what you mean.
Yeah.
There are adulting moments when your children flee the nest.
Yeah. Adulting. And, so I was very happy. Dad was happy to get Quip. Get it for your adult children or for yourself. And actually, because
or for your young children.
Or young children, right? You know, yeah. This is fun. They like brushing with this.
Yeah, they like it.
And by the way, I should mention that the different colors are helpful because you can have, four different people in your bathroom at the same time. And you'll all know which toothbrush is whose by the Quip color. I really like my Quip. GetQuip.com. So this Apple event, here's what I think. And Ming-Chi Kuo, who is one of the Apple rumor guys, he's one with a real supply side bent because he's an analyst in China. And he says, according to Ming, that Apple is going to do, yes, for education, as you said, Georgia, finally, a inexpensive, because I don't think Apple sells anything less than 1,000, maybe even more than that.
Finally, not a laptop.
Yeah, finally, an inexpensive MacBook Air. And by the way, I'm just thrilled they're going to keep selling the MacBook Air because that's great. With a Retina display, which is something that they needed to do. He says $799 to $899, which would be kind of necessary for a school. The current MacBook Air starts at $999.
Yeah, it's still too expensive, but yeah.
I wish it were less. I mean, you're competing against $300 Chromebooks. Microsoft, it's funny. Microsoft Apple already was out of the classroom. They weren't even competitive. It was Windows, cheap Windows machines, and even they have been losing ground to Chromebooks. And one of the things I got this week, I'll show you, is I think Microsoft's kind of trying to answer this Chromebook threat with something called Windows 10S and less expensive computers. This is the first Windows computer based on the ARM processor. It's not Windows RT. This is Windows 10S running on a Snapdragon Qualcomm chip, 835. Now, it's a little pricey. It's $1,000, but it does include the keyboard and the pen. It comes from HP. It's called the NVX2. I got it because I'm very curious what these are like, given that they're running not on desktop processors, but on mobile processors. They're claiming 22 hours battery life. It sure is the longest battery life I've ever gotten. I doubt it'll be 22 hours. You know, I haven't really been able to completely test it, but I would say, fairly heavy use for over a 24-hour period, so maybe 12, 15 hours. The only negative is it is slow. It's not slow if you only do Windows 10S and Microsoft's Edge browser. That feels pretty snappy. But put Chrome on it, you'll be sorry. And you can, because you can upgrade to Windows 10 Pro with all of these Windows 10S things.
It's just still too complicated. I think that those things are getting crushed in education because the Chromebook is so simple. You flip it on, it turns on right away, like instant on.
It's secure.
They're so cheap. You're not saving data in it. You know, Google Docs is huge in education for obvious reasons.
And Google Classroom as well.
Google Classroom, they've now made that much more widely available. And Google is just absolutely crushing Microsoft and Apple in the classroom. And I don't think that this this thing that they're doing, I think it's good that they're having a cheaper MacBook Air. I think that's smart just in general. I think there's lots of regular workers that could use that device and be happy with it. We have we have a lot of MacBook Airs in our company.
People love MacBook Airs.
People are holding on to them, right? They're holding on to them for a long time.
A new MacBook Air will do great. It just won't be in the classroom.
It will not be in the classroom. It's too expensive, yeah. Other than the most, other than some private schools, right that are going to hand these out, and some students who will buy them themselves or their parents will buy them for them.
Right.
It'll do well, but it's going to be, the same segment of the market that Apple already has, right? The upper sort
and somebody's of saying about this Windows on ARM, if it doesn't run Chrome well, but that's exactly what a Chromebook does do, which is run Chrome well.
Yeah.
That's a huge differentiator. That's not going to serve Microsoft very well on these Windows on ARM devices.
I met with some IT administrators of a school. I think it was about a year ago, and I said, what is it about the Chromebook that you like? And they went, it works and it's secure.
Yeah.
I don't think Microsoft will never win in the education market.
They can't win that way. Yeah.
Because it's not safe, it's not secure, and it's not actually easy to operate. To install the operating system on that device is a massive pain in the butt, whereas a Chromebook is trivial. Every time you turn it on, it basically loads the operating system from scratch.
Can Apple succeed in this environment? Can an iPad, for instance?
I think that the iPads could. I think that the problem is that once a school has invested, one, of teaching teachers how to be able to use a certain set of technology, it's really hard to teach them something else. I think that iPads, they're not that expensive. They're kind of pricey, but they're not that expensive. They're definitely safe and secure. They're very easy to use. But the teachers are already proved to be able to use it, and there's already probably Chromebooks in the school. And so what they're going to do is they're not going to throw all these Chromebooks out. If they're going to invest in others, they're not going to then train teachers to be able to use iPads and the different systems that are there, because all of the schools in our area are set up to Google Classroom. And so I think that it's going to be an uphill battle for Apple, and they really need to give something that's going to cause a push and make it affordable. Because in the end, schools work on the bottom line. Like, unless you're a private school, you're working on how much money can you save? Because if you take from one area, if you give to one area, you're taking from another. And so I think it's going to be hard for Apple to crack through.
They're doing well in like the K through about three, the iPads, right? iPads are still pretty simple for those, for those kids. And they are still doing well in a lot of schools that are using that. But once you get a kid to where they have to write something, they have to, do a response paper, they have to, maybe work some basic software on their own. By software, I mean usually websites, right? Then almost all of them that we see, and all the schools that we talk to, and administrators and CIOs of schools and school systems, I should say, their Chromebook is almost 100% of what we see.
There's no incentive to go to Apple. Apple's got no incentive to introduce a low-cost device, because if they do, they undercut everything. So if they introduced a $500 MacBook, people are going to stop buying the $1,000 MacBook.
They're built on margins.
It's all about ARPU.
It's
all about increasing the average revenue per user. Its share price is going to get slammed if they suddenly introduce something cheap. So, no, they're done with the education market.
But they can't be, because they're having an event at prep school a week from Tuesday. There's something going on here.
They're going to make some faux attempt. And Microsoft can't win in this market either, because its products are rubbish. They're unsafe to use. They're constantly insecure, and they're too hard to administer. Down on the ground, even if they could match the price of the Chromebook, even if Microsoft could squeeze its corporate soul to do something right for a change, it still couldn't make it so that the administration, the people who actually put the computers in front of the kids, need something that just works every time they take it off the rack.
How long can a school use a Chromebook? 2, 3, 4 years? What is the
Easily.
Easily. Okay.
3 or 4 years.
Because an iPad, really, after 2 years, is unusable. right? It's just, you know, and if it survives handling
two
by
to
a
three.
Student.
Yeah, they're like 2 to 3, I'd say, you know, because
so even if Apple gets the iPads down, and the rumor is that there'll be a 9.7-inch iPad for $259, even if the Apple gets the price down there, that's not going to be, for most administrators, enough of a pitch. And besides, you don't just get iPads. Now you have to get charging stations. You have to get curriculum. You have to
lightning
teach
cables,
the teacher.
It's a power whole, jacks.
Yeah, it's completely. Yeah.
Now you have to rewrite all of your, get your teachers to rewrite all of the classes.
Yeah.
No.
It's not an easy
thing. If Apple decided to donate and to be able to give to a certain set of schools, and they were going to be able to train all of the teachers, I think that that would be a big push for them. And
which
be
they
able
may
to kind
do.
Of get
That's a good point. Yeah.
It's going
to
take that, though.
Refurbished, you know, systems. Or if they even said, like, they would, you know, do a free fix, and, you know, if you break something, we're going to fix it for free. I think that Apple has the – they could be able to do that, and that would start a system. And then once people are kind of stuck in the ecosphere, odds are they're going to continue to. And so if Apple was willing to support the school systems, I think that would be a really big deal for Apple.
We do know, I'm sure, that they will talk about something called ClassKit, which we've seen in beta for iOS 11.3. It's a framework for educational apps. So, I mean, this is going to be a push from Apple, but I can't imagine it'll be too compelling for
K through three. I think you got to think of it as K through 3. It's gonna be really good for them, and probably you're likely to see. I think George's points is a great one. They're likely to partner with some schools, especially ones that don't have access to good technology, and they're likely to either donate or give them at a massive discount. But to Greg's point, you still have to support it. And so that's its own challenge. And so Apple's probably going to have to, you know, have a larger program in place there. And then these other things, the MacBook and other, it's going to support, again, the same percent of the market that Apple already owns, which is that like top 10%. They cherry pick the best part of the market where the biggest margins are, where the people that can afford it typically want to invest in a Mac versus a PC. And they will want to keep that in education in the same way they do in the larger market.
There is something going on at Apple, though. I'm going to refer to Neil Seibert's Above Avalon blog. He published a couple of days ago. He's observed that Apple's R&D spend has jumped hugely. They're going to spend more in fiscal year 2018 than they spent from 1998 to 2011 together. And that, by the way, that decade or more saw the launch of the iPod, the iPhone, and the iPad. So they're spending something a lot. It's traditionally Apple's not known for their R&D expenditure. But
they have to. They know that they're not on to the next big thing, right? And so they're trying everything. They're trying cars. They're trying healthcare. They're trying education. They're trying. I think you're probably seeing a lot of that is in healthcare. They really think that they've got a good thing going there, and they think, you know, with 11.3 iOS 11.3, the biggest thing in there, ClassKit is in there, but the new health record is in there, and. You know, that has the potential, we've done some coverage of this, you know, that has some potential to be a potential winner for them, at least in the U.S. market, where it's so bifurcated, not bifurcated, but, you know,
fragmented.
Not
fragmented.
Fragmented. Thank you. Where, you know, in terms of health records and these health systems not being able to share records, and then people not being able to carry their own records with them. So they have a great opportunity there. They see it. And I think you see them working more and more with companies that are doing health, either not just health care, but proactive health kind of things, from folks like Sleep Number to other companies that are making health devices. They're working really closely with a lot of them. So you have to think that they're making some of these bets where their kind of next sort of big market push could be.
Actually, you know, it's interesting because, and I'm sure, Georgia, you're doing this too. Apple has with their Apple Watch a heart health thing. Mm-hmm. It's a heart study that they're doing. Where they're collecting information about heart rate and AFib, and I've done this, and you can sign up for it. But Samsung has just announced a new phone that does something very interesting, that competes directly with this. And they're doing a study with UCSF. And I did not realize this. Samsung has not touted this. But the new Samsung Galaxy S9 has apparently not just a heart rate monitor, which Samsung phones have had for a while, where you can put your finger on a little sensor right under the flash and it will tell you what your heart rate is. But apparently that sensor can also now measure blood pressure. And that's a big first, something the Apple Watch and the iPhone do not do. They are partnering with UCSF. They've launched an app which I've been using called My BP Lab, which apparently allows them to measure blood pressure by the smartphone without any external hardware. I signed up for it. I need to measure my BP using this phone 3 times a day. And then they do questionnaires like, were you in the room with a loved one while you were getting your blood pressure? Have you had sex lately? Have you called Get Roman? No, they didn't ask me that. But it was interesting that this is going to be a study. I don't know if you know anything about this, but this is going to be a study. It's a three-week study for you. You'd be part of a three-week study that measures not just blood pressure, but sleep, exercise, diet. And I guess they're trying to look for some sort of correlation, as Apple is doing with the heart rate.
I think it's wonderful. I always wonder, you know, Apple, I maybe perhaps naively trust with my data, and I feel very comfortable with that because we pay a premium for that kind of thing. And, right. You know, if you're not paying a premium, then you probably are what's making the company money. I worry about people putting in a lot of information to Samsung, because in the end, then if the government gets that jobs or your company finds out that you have a heart issue, they may say, you know what, you're going to be really expensive to us and we don't want to hire you. And so I would just read through all of the privacy information before you sign up something that
I did. I feel like it's okay.
Did you actually read through? Do you read through all of the EULAs and privacy? No.
Now my blood pressure's going up. You're ruining my blood pressure.
True.
I was going to say, were you with Georgia Dow during this? No, I'm actually measuring my blood pressure right now. Yeah. It says, please keep still.
You want me to do mine? I can do mine. I've got my...
You have a cuff. I have one of those cuff. Too, from Y Things. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I used to have that.
There's a company that's gone nowhere since it was acquired.
Samsung owns them now, right? Notice even Samsung's not using a Y-Things cuff. They're just doing it with their phone. My blood pressure is 4.7 below my baseline measurement. So I'm actually
You're
very relaxed.
Than usual.
Who's currently in the room with you? Strangers. have you exercised vigorously in the last 30 minutes? Absolutely not. How are you feeling? Are you positive and activated? Negative and activated? Positive and not activated? Negative and not activated?
Negative after all that security talk.
I mean, positive. How intensely are you feeling positive and activated? Georgia, you'd probably recognize this as a kind of a standard, you know, kind of personality inventory.
Exactly. They want to kind of track everything that you're going through. Though I think that those questions seem like positive and activated would be more confusing than most standard.
They give you more descriptions. They give you more descriptions. Do you feel bored? Do you wish you were somewhere else? Indicate by tapping on the line below.
Don't lie. We're watching. Don't lie. You're lying.
Okay, maybe a little bit. No, I
thought Facebook was giving away a lot of information. There's an awful lot of data.
Do you feel like things are overwhelming right now?
If I could correlate that data with what you've been doing on Facebook, I'd know an awful lot about you.
Well, I quit Facebook. I quit Facebook so I could give the University of California at San... Wait a minute. We have trouble authenticating your account. Oh, man. Now I got to do it all over again. That's the second time that's happened. There's a bug in there. I don't know what's going on. But I think it's interesting. I mean, they don't tell you your blood pressure, I notice, but they do claim, and Samsung claims, and UCSF, which I don't think is lying to me, they have a very good medical school. I claim that they're getting blood
pressure.
It's
probably not exceptionally accurate, and that's why they don't want to give you a specific number. Because that's caused a lot of people to freak out. Then they'll be going to see their doctors, then the doctors will be angry at Samsung.
I know you're Canadian, but wouldn't they need FDA in the U.S. anyway approval to do something like that?
No, not for blood pressure cuffs, because you're not administering any medication. And they would say, like, listen, you should always check this with probably, you know, they probably have somewhere in that form that you didn't read. They probably have a coverage to be able to say, you know.
Yeah.
This well, might I know not be with fact. The, it might be the, like FTC more like than FDA.
Right.
Maybe.
I know with the Apple Heart thing, if they see something abnormal, a doctor will do a FaceTime with you, and you get a consultation.
If you're registered with a study.
Well, you have to register to do it.
Yeah, you don't get that in the UK, for example.
Oh, interesting. Because they're not allowed to collect that.
Yeah, and the doctors won't usually take what's in your watch because it's not calibrated.
Right. And you already have health insurance. Here we don't have any of that.
Yes, there is.
We're on our own, baby.
So I was talking to a doctor about it recently. I had to go in and have some meat maintenance done on the chassis here. And they said that, you know, they don't like to take the data that comes from cuffs or watches because they've not been calibrated.
Right.
It turns out that the gear in the hospitals and so forth is all calibrated and tested regularly to make sure that the results are accurate. That's and so very, unless you can prove that, blah, 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 blah.
That's a very good point.
That makes sense. Eventually, I'm sure that those devices will be, you know, within normal parameters and that will go away. But that certainly makes sense, also, you know.
And you're also asking for the medical people to accept it as well. Which is not something that.
That's true.
Yeah. Let's just say that the medical system is not exactly a center, a hotbed of innovation.
Indeed. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back with more. We've got Greg Farrow from the Packet Pushers Network here. Packet Pushers. Is it packetpushers.net? It should be.
Packetpushers.net, yes. Yeah. I strongly recommend you don't listen to it unless you are a nerd.
Well, you could say that about this show, too. At Ethereal Mind on Twitter. Georgia Dow, she's with iMore. And senior editor there at Georgia_Dow on Twitter. And don't forget, she's also a licensed psychotherapist. We bring her in on a regular basis to fix me. And it's still not working, by the way, Georgia. But I have to say, I'm very happy to have your anxiety videos. Actually, your partner sent me the whole set, which is really good.
Yes, me and my partner. I didn't say not to send them.
Okay. You didn't stop her. But these are great. These are not just anxiety, but she's got DVDs on things like sleeping better, boundaries mm-hmm. and consequences.
That's a good one.
One of these days I'll watch that one. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I got no boundaries. Special series on parenting. This is a really great series, and I want to tell everybody about it so they can go look at anxiety-videos.com. And who doesn't want more of Georgia on their screen after all, right? Mm-hmm. And your wonderful partner who sent me the DVDs.
Yes, Sandra. I'll
even though you didn't stop her.
I didn't mean it like
that. No, it's okay. I give you credit too. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
And Jason Heiner, who is always welcome on our network. We love having him on. Editor, actually, all of you, our editor in chief at Tech Republic. Great to have you back as well at Jason Heiner on Twitter. Our show today brought to you by Quicken Loans. We should set off some fireworks, light a candle or something, because Quicken Loans, as of a couple of months ago, became the number one lender in the country. We've always said number one in your hearts, number one in the J.D. Power customer satisfaction polls for 8 years running for mortgage origination, 4 years running for mortgage servicing. I mean, they really are good. Now they're also the number one lender overall in the country. And I think I'm going to take some credit for that. We've been telling you about Quicken Loans for some time. You know, they're revitalizing Detroit. They've done a great job. And they also understand that we geeks are a little different. Maybe it's because we don't understand emotional cues. I don't know. But we don't. When we want to buy a house, the last thing you want to do, go to a bank, say, please, sir, can I have a loan? A loan? Well, fill out this 30-page application and we'll get back to you. So you fill out the application and then you're not done. You got to go to the attic, find pay stubs, balance, check statements, all the paperwork, fax it. Who has a fax machine? Fax it into. I don't have a fax machine. This was very 18th century, 19th century maybe. I mean, this is not. So Quicken Loans said, look, we can do better. Dan said, we got computers now. What if we had a loan approval process you did all online? You didn't have to go to a bank. You didn't have to fill out an application. You didn't have to go to the attic. You could do it all on your phone or on a computer. That's when Rocket Mortgage was born. Goodbye paperwork. Do it all at rocketmortgage.com/twit2. And what I love about this is completely simple. You just answer a few questions you already know the answer to. They have partnerships with all the financial institutions. So with your permission, they get your information. And then they crunch the numbers based on your income, your assets, your credit. They will say, here's the loans you qualify for. You choose the rate, the term, the down payment, completely transparent, and you got a loan. And all of this, beginning to end, not including the time it took to put on your pants, 8 minutes, because you don't have to put on your pants. 8 minutes. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently with Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. To get started, in fact, even if you're not in the midst of buying a house right now, maybe tomorrow you're going to go to an open house, or maybe you're going to see something you really like, or maybe you want to refi because rates aren't going up. This would be a good time to refi. To get started, create that account right now, rocketmortgage.com/twit2. rocketmortgage.com/twit and the number 2. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, and MLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030. Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. rocketmortgage.com/twit and the number 2. Couple of stories to wrap things up. I had a good one. This is not a good one, but it's a sad one. But I should mention, of course, Stephen Hawking passed away this week at the age of 76. Show of hands, how many of you own A Brief History of Time? How many of you have actually read it? Oh, you read it. You read it. Very nice. You read it.
I don't know if I understood everything in it.
I got the illustrated version. So I looked at the pictures. Does that count?
That counts.
100%. 100%.
I saw the movie, The Theory of Everything. I saw that. We played a little video on the new screensavers. I won't do it today. If you saw it already, it's a beautiful video. It was put together in honor of Professor Hawking's 75th birthday. But he was very, important, not just to physicists, for his theories about black hole and information, but also to all of us, because he was such an inspiration. Here's a guy with a great mind whose body completely failed him. He got ALS in his 20s, lived another 50 years, basically unable to move. He could speak only with the help of a computer. In fact, he's very famous for beginning all of his talks with, "Can you hear me?" in his synthesized voice, and it became kind of his trademark. Here's a guy whose mind shone so brightly that his body transcended his body. And I think he was a great inspiration to all of us.
It's a great way to say it.
Yeah. I quoted the poet Wordsworth's words about Isaac Newton, and I think that they completely appropriately described Stephen Hawking, a mind forever voyaging through strange worlds alone. A great man, Stephen Hawking. We're sorry to lose him. Not the only person the tech community lost this week. Adrian Lamo passed away as well. We knew Adrian fairly well. He'd been on... you're not logged into Facebook either, huh, Karsten? I can't read. This is what happens. You can't read it if you're not on Facebook. But his father... Mario Lamo posted these words on Friday: "With great sadness and a broken heart, I have to let all of Adrian's friends and acquaintances know he is dead. A bright mind and compassionate soul is gone. He was my beloved song." Lamo was a controversial figure, a hacker who was, we often called him the homeless hacker. Even when we had interviewed him on the new screensavers and the old screensavers, he was always on the road, always peripatetic. He actually ended his days in Kansas. He had lived in the San Francisco Bay Area for a while and was quite famous for having hacked a number of companies, including Yahoo, the New York Times, and Microsoft, not to get in, but merely to show that their security, in effect, he considered himself a pen tester, that their security was inadequate, although he kind of raised the ire of the New York Times when he added himself to the New York Times editorial board. That was a line too far. The Times went after him, and in 2004 he was indicted, turned himself in. We actually had a conversation with him right before he turned himself in to the FBI. He received a home detention sentence. He wasn't in prison. And, of course, then afterwards was very outspoken activist for hackers, for rights. And I think a really great guy. Don't know what happened. The Kansas police say it was not foul play. I fear to learn more. I hope. I don't know what his mental state was towards the end. He had been hospitalized for Asperger's in the past. And he was most controversial because he was the hacker who turned in then Bradley Manning, now Chelsea Manning, when she was exfiltrated a bunch of information and put it on WikiLeaks about the U.S. government, some memos and so forth. I don't know if he regretted it. I think he felt like he didn't have any choice. He had been talking to Manning on chat rooms, found out what Manning had done, and it ended up turning her in. Manning, of course, served 7 years in prison and was later, her sentence was commuted by President Obama about a year ago, a little more than a year ago. So sorry to lose Adrian as well. You know, he's kind of a mixed bag.
Yep.
Like all of us.
Right? Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah. Back in the days when security hacking was mostly about pranking people.
Yeah, I know him, and I know he was never malicious, never used his abilities, his vast hacking abilities, to hurt anybody. So
no, but pranks.
But yeah. But
pranks.
Putting his name on the I like that. Putting your name on the New York Times editorial
board. That's right,
board.
Yeah. Corporate entities don't have a sense of humor.
They don't like that, no.
They tend to react badly to pranking.
SEC has begun.
They react badly to bug bounties as well, by the way.
Pardon me?
They react badly to people shorting their stock instead of getting a bug bounty.
That's not, that could be a problem down the road as well. Elizabeth Holmes, CEO of Theranos, and Theranos's former president, Sonny Balwani, are now being charged by the Securities and Exchange Commission for fraud. They raised more than $700 million, you know, for Theranos. The SEC alleges they exaggerated and made false statements about the company's technology. They were supposedly developing a technology for blood testing that required just a pinprick, a little dot of blood. It never did work, and there's some evidence that they knew that for years. But nevertheless, there will be an investigation at this point. SEC has filed complaints against Theranos, Elizabeth Holmes, and Sonny Balwani, claiming that Theranos' products were deployed by the U.S. Department of Defense on the battlefield in Afghanistan on medevac helicopters. The company generated more than $100 million in revenue in 2014. Oh, they claimed it. I'm sorry. Theranos claimed that they never were deployed and generated less than $100,000 in revenue from operations.
There's a whole bunch of questions here about the viability of Silicon Valley investors. These people have given this person $700 million on the theory, and you would imagine that they had done some due diligence and actually validated that the claims that these people made were reasonable. And it's obviously clear that at any cursory inspection of the technology would have shown up that they were lying through their teeth.
Yeah.
It does really question the validity of the Silicon Valley investment community if they cannot actually detect someone who's just flat out lying, exaggerating, and then dissembling for years on years. And then to be caught out like this is incredibly embarrassing, I think.
Well, and
there's such a fervor to catch out onto the fastest, the
that's
best
it.
New
you don't want to miss
big
it,
thing
right?
That people, you know, gravitate for it. And they did make really good looking, you know, presentations.
She wore
with
a black turtleneck. She was the female Steve Jobs.
Yeah. And in fairness, there were plenty of VCs that called bunk on it and was like, I just don't believe that they're even close to anything. But they convinced enough people to buy into it, to buy into the
and
promise.
And it starts gaining, you know, momentum.
Well,
people
you look
keep
at
on
companies,
talking about it.
I mean, they raised $700 million, but how much has Uber raised? $10 billion almost over? They've lost, I should say, almost $10 billion over 10 years. Never showed a profit. On the other hand, you could look at both Theranos and Uber and say, well, if they succeed, this is going to be a windfall. And the problem is, you're right, that due diligence.
And Uber is a product versus this didn't even, it was a scam, right?
Well,
it was a scam and she's gotten away with it. It's a $500,000 fine and she's barred from being the director of a company, but she still walked off with millions in cash.
Yeah, what I wonder is what the investors, shouldn't they be howling for her blood and more than a pinprick?
Potentially, I assume there's going to be lawsuits where they're trying to recover.
Yeah.
Agreed.
There's
civil lawsuits to recover now that
there will be.
So
but she hasn't admitted guilt here. The SEC has charged her with lying, but she hasn't admitted guilt.
Oh,
she's
no.
just settled the court case.
Yeah. Plattsburgh, New York. Good place to live if you want cheap electricity. 4 cents a kilowatt hour. It's the lowest in the country. That's why so many Bitcoin miners have moved there. And it's,
is it near a hydroelectric or
it
something?
It is. It's okay. Near hydroelectric. Okay. And as a result, the City Council of Pittsburgh on Thursday unanimously voted to impose an 18-month moratorium on Bitcoin mining.
Well, after the Bitcoin mining is done, I bet you're going to see some. It's a great publicity for that place.
Exactly.
Though, you're going to see people. Google's going to open up a data center there, like, you know, in 3, 2, 1. You know, I mean, it's like.
Yeah. Bitcoin mining now uses more power than the country of Poland. And is well on its way to accelerating global climate change, all to generate some profits for some Bitcoin bros.
I mean, the funny thing to think about, you know, the Bitcoin mining thing obviously has a reputation now, but it's actually a fairly ingenious thing because it's needed in order to make the ledger distributed, right? Like it gives you the incentive.
Proof of work, yeah.
Yeah, it's a brilliant, brilliant concept. Obviously, it's gone too far, and you know,
some flaws in it. We need to maybe back to the drawing board and think of a way to do this without using up all the electricity in the world.
Indeed. Also, it's almost impossible to get high end.
Oh, GPUs,
because the Bitcoin.
How are you playing your video games? Huh? I mean,
Well, my husband actually took
really important medical research, not just video games. Really important medical research and other things are used for that.
What did your husband do?
My husband took old MacBook and an eGPU graphics adapter to try to figure out how he could mine Ethereum.
Oh man!
And it worked. It worked. You can do this too.
Did he make any money?
This article. He's going to lose $3 in a month.
Where's the article?
It's on iMore. You can just look up how to mine Ethereum on iMore. Yeah.
Is Ethereum as inefficient as Bitcoin or is it a little bit better?
It's
you know what?
Bad.
That's he didn't try for mining Bitcoin, so I'm not really sure. He's going to have
effectively.
To test them
out. Yeah. Here it is. Yeah. How to mine Ethereum with your MacBook and eGPU. Anthony Casella, that's your husband?
That's my husband.
I didn't know that.
Met him.
I'm going to call you. I know I did. I'm going to call you Georgia Casella from now.
Oh, yeah. So in Quebec, you don't take your husband's name.
I know you don't.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, it's very strange.
No, Georgia Dow is such a perfect name. I wouldn't change a thing.
So the interesting part about this story, I think, Leo, is we're also seeing the same thing happen in Iceland. So this isn't unique to America.
Oh, yes,
what is unique about the American story is the lack of infrastructure. So there's a lot of talk in the press, particularly if you're into data centers like I am. I get very excited about data centers and discussing them. But the problem with data centers is that there's not enough the American US grid where they distribute the electricity across the backbone of the country at, you know, megawatts is in such poor condition that they're generating the electricity there, but they can't transport it to where it's being consumed. And that's why it's the cheapest electricity, because it's literally just the hydro plants are producing more electricity than they can put into the grid.
Right.
Yeah. Because nobody's building the power lines to take the power to where it needs to be.
There is good news. I think the Russians are about to take over our grid, and I'm sure one of the first things they'll do is make it more efficient.
I'm sure that that's exactly what they do. We're also seeing the same thing happen in Iceland. So Iceland also, because they have the geothermal capability. So I dropped a link into the chat room. Have a look at that. Same story. The interesting part about this is there's electricity, but these things are also placed in places where there's no networking. So normal data centers like Amazon or Google can't build data centers there because there's no data infrastructure in place.
Right.
Bitcoin doesn't need vast amounts of bandwidth like Google and AWS and Microsoft Azure and those types of people do. So these are great places to put mining centers because they don't need the high bandwidth, but they do need the power. So it is actually an interesting infrastructural play if you look at the technology of it.
An update.
Yeah, the U.S. is, you know, it's funny, the power grid thing hasn't come up in a while in the U.S. It is still a huge problem. It's been about 5 years ago since I went to a big press conference at the White House where their big announcement was, okay, we're, you know, making real progress on this power grid stuff. And they rolled out this huge plan, massive, you know, multi-decade plan to upgrade the power grid. But it's like, it's extremely difficult to get updates, and not before change administration even, to get updates on like, how is that coming? How are we doing?
Let me guess. It's been, exactly.
But I'm just saying it's a known problem, and it's fallen off the radar, even though it's so critical to the future of our infrastructure.
Our infrastructure is melting down
everywhere.
It's just melting down.
It's very difficult, actually, because they're now already predicting the end of the rise, the adoption of new light bulbs, LED bulbs, the low-powered devices. We're seeing computers replaced with smartphones. You're seeing efficient appliances. So electricity demand
is mostly going down in the first world.
It's actually flat declining slightly.
Yeah. It's flat. Yeah.
That's interesting.
And increasingly, with the arrival of electric vehicles and the tail off of demand, we're actually seeing there's a possibility that CO2 is going to be a happy story. We're actually seeing drops in the production of CO2. So if you follow the Bloomberg Energy Forum, they're talking about how the predictions for CO2 production may actually be overly aggressive, and we may actually have some hope to survive climate change if the trends to electric cars and, you know, power efficient houses and so forth.
And if people stop mining Bitcoin.
Well, I think Bitcoin is overblown. I mean,
but with electric cars, isn't that going to drive up demand again? Sorry, isn't electric cars going to drive up the demand potentially? You know,
I'm very proud to say we got 30 solar panels on our house because we were getting an electric car, so that
that's exactly why the demand for the grid, because you'll see distributed grid,
right?
So where you put
by the way, at least here in California, over our power company's dead bodies, they hate the idea of a distributed grid. Even though they're quasi not-for-profit organizations, they are ultimately for-profit organizations, and they don't want to see consumers generating their own power. So they make it as hard as it possibly could be.
These things will change over time.
They have
changing.
To. Yeah.
But you know, the point is that we're talking about in the technology space where I operate, we're talking about this edge computing thing, about how today we're moving everything into the data center, and now we're talking about going out to the edge. Well, if you start to do the math around edge computing and how everything's going to have computers at the edge, there's not enough power in the world, but you can generate 2 kilowatts to run a good sized edge data center just from a couple of solar panels and a couple of bags of batteries, right? If you can run a car.
That's exactly what Stephen Hawking discovered, that the universe is expanding and then will turn into a giant black hole and contract again.
That's right.
So there you go.
It has to be a distributed power grid. Everybody will do some generation locally, and I think we'll see the emergence of some sort of storage technology where your house will store.
That's the key, isn't it? Storage.
Or cities will have a local storage array, whether it's, you know, air pumped into an underground reservoir or water pumped up into a tower and then it drops down and acts like a pseudo hydro. There'll be some sort of, there's dozens of different ways this could work out. We'll see how it works out over time.
To that effect, one of the coolest things that I learned about recently in the last 6 months was a company, well-heeled company, that's doing some research on floors that actually take the energy of people walking around in the floors and convert that into usable energy. It's the same process through which, you know, the Prius brakes, right? And it takes that energy and converts it into usable energy. Well, this, you know, it takes a battery system similar to like Powerwall, but it takes the floors so if they put these into normal floors in the same way that, you know, Elon Musk wants to put them into, you know, regular shingles. And so your floors actually can take that energy of people walking. Not just in houses, but you can imagine it in somewhere like Grand Central Station, right? And you convert that energy into usable energy. Super, super cool stuff.
They're also
thinking about doing the same thing with, you know, speed bumps to be able to do the same thing and roadways. It's just, you know, to be able to convert that power and store it in a way that's really efficient.
I think this would be a good time on an up note to end the show. So we're all feeling good and positive, because it was pretty negative at the beginning here. Jason Heiner from Tech Republic, thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate it. At Jason Heiner.
Very good.
Anything you're up to?
Your book?
Follow the Geeks.
Follow the Geeks on Audible. You can find it on Audible and on Amazon. And the sample chapter on Audible, as I always say, is chapter 9, Leo Laporte.
Very, very good book. It's the closest I'll ever get to having a memoir. It is, I highly recommend it. And Jason, you and Lindsay did a great job interviewing me and writing up my story. But not just me, lots of interesting people. And frankly, if you're a Twitch fan, you'll probably recognize a lot of the names in this book. It's really, really
definitely
a great read or a great listen on Audible. Thank you, Jason. Georgia Dow, always a thrill, always a pleasure. Things going
Thank
well
you
for you?
Me. Yeah. Things are on the upswing. It can't get any worse. So.
Oh yeah, Georgia lost her mom a couple of months ago, and I know that's been a tough time. But we're glad.
Yeah.
We're glad you're feeling better. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for being here. And congratulations on marrying Anthony. That's really good. I've seen his byline for a long time, and I didn't put two and two together. Yeah.
Yes, that's true. There's no picture or anything there, right?
No, I just didn't put two and two together.
Oh.
Thank you, Georgia. Greg Farrow, you're a pistol. Always a pleasure to have you on Packet Pushers. I know gun control is an issue, but nobody's going to control that mouth. PacketPushers.net, Ethereal Mind on the Twitter. Greg, you're a pleasure to have on, and I know it's now after midnight, so we're gonna have to let you go. I think.
No problems. Thanks very much for having me back.
You're losing an hour tonight, right?
Yes. The clocks change. I'm sitting here looking at my clock, wondering if it's going to change before we wrap up tonight. But
if you stay,
thanks very much for having me on the show, Leo. As always, it's a huge pleasure. It's loads of fun.
You're the greatest. Thank you, Greg. Thank you, everybody, for being here. We had a great studio audience. Thank you for joining us. If you want to be in the studio, just email tickets@twit.tv. There's no charge. We'd love to have you, and we'd like to know you're coming so we don't get surprised. We thought there were going to be 12 people. Burke was putting out chairs for 12 people. I don't know. We thought there'd be more. So thank you, you few, you hardy, you brave souls who braved the snow to get here. I don't know.
Shout out to the Hoosiers, too.
The Hoosiers. We got a lot of Hoosiers in the house. If you want to watch live, you can also watch our live stream. You don't have to come here. You just go to twit.tv/live. If you do that, though, make sure you join us in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. A big part of the show, your feedback, your comments. I'm always watching the chat room. That's 3 p.m. Pacific every Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern time, 2200 UTC. Please stop by and say hi. If you can't watch on demand, you can't be in studio. I can't watch live and can't be in studio. We still have on-demand versions of all our shows on our website. This Week in Tech is at twit.tv, or subscribe. That way you don't have to do anything. It'll just appear magically on your phone the minute it's done. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time. Another Twit is in the can. Bye-bye.